Everybody, welcome back to the Made for TV Mayhem Show. We have been gone for a little bit longer than I was planning for various reasons, but we're back. My name is Amanda Reyes. I'm so happy to be here. I'm really happy because I was going to use the phrase down under with Mark Harmon, but we're kind of going underwater with Mark Harmon, and I couldn't figure out how to sex that up. But we're basically going to be swimming around with Mark Harmon for a couple hours here, and I'm really excited about it. I've been looking forward to it for a long time. But also, I should say what we're talking about. So tonight we're covering our first mini-series, which I'm really excited about. I thought a good way to come back into the new year would be to pick kind of a deep cut movie that I'm not sure a lot of people are familiar with called Goliath Awaits, which is interesting for a number of different reasons. One, because it has this amazing cast that is unlike any cast I've ever seen in a TV movie before. Number two, it's a miniseries. So that's something we haven't done yet. And I know that we should have picked maybe Salem's Lot or something that maybe would resonate more with listeners, but I'm really hoping to turn people onto this movie because it's really good. But the main reason why I picked it, and we're not going to go too deep into it, is that Robert Forster has a very sizable part in this, or as I would say, size, yes. Okay, so we'll introduce our friend here in a minute who is going to laugh at everything I say about member and part. But Robert Forster, as many of you know, passed away late last year, I think in October, and he's probably at least in my top five all-time favorite actors, and he was my ultimate crush. I have been in love with him for a very long time, and I've met him twice. And he was a really sweet man and really beautiful in person and just an immense talent. And when he passed away, I thought I would really like to cover some of his films. And he did do a lot of TV movies. The thing is that even though he doesn't star in this per se, although he has a really big role in it, I think that this was just such a great film for us to talk about and to introduce hopefully to people. Or if people have actually seen it when it originally aired, maybe it'll bring back some good feelings for you. It's a really interesting film with a really interesting history. And so we're going to dive into that. But let me introduce who we have with us tonight. And then let's go ahead and we're going to do a little housekeeping real quick. And then we'll dive right into the movie. So, of course, I'm here with my friend Dan. Hey, Dan, how's it going?
Going okay. I'm excited. I've been hoping we'd do a mini series for ages, and now we've finally done one, and I'm very excited.
Yeah, this was also a good one because it only ran over two nights. Because like we could do the Winds of War, but that would be ridiculous, right?
I'd suggest we do America, which is what 14 hours long, but you put the kibosh on that.
Yeah, you also suggested Fresno, and I'm saying out loud here because I want to commit us to that at some point. But I've been saying we're going to do things, and then we haven't gotten around to them. But it would be really great if we did Fresno because that's an extraordinary piece of filmmaking that I love. Did you have a good holiday?
I did. It was very nice. Santa was very good to me. I'll be honest, when the New Year hit, I kind of fell asleep right after watching New Year's Evil at around 10 p.m., which happens. And I woke up and it was 3 in the morning. And I was like, hey, and I went back to sleep. But apart from that, it was a very lovely. I always enjoy Christmas time and everything. So it's nice to – and we are recording this on the leap year. So this is a very special recording.
It is. It's actually a Saturday, which is kind of unique for us. So we tried to arrange everybody's schedules because we have a special guest who I'm going to introduce here in a second. But I will say that Nate was with us till the very last minute, and then he had to drop out for, you know, because he has a life and things he has to take care of. So that was very sad for us, and we hope he comes back soon. But luckily, we had lined up a very special guest, so there's going to be three of us tonight, and I'm so excited about it. We have one of my favorite people on the planet here with us. His name is Gore Blimey. That's his birth name.
Yes.
I swear to God. And
Gore Blimey Jones.
And he's not only a very special person, but he also has an amazing podcast called the Trilogy of Terror podcast. Yes. The premise of it is that he takes a director and then he covers three films by that director. And he does some really interesting filmmakers, Lamberto Bava being one of the first episodes he did, if not the first one, I can't remember. That was really marvelous. And but he also does things where he talks a lot about short films. And he did something over Christmas that was really interesting where he talked about three Christmas films with his guest, and it was really wonderful. And so anyway, hey, Gore Blimey, how are you?
I'm very good, thanks. Especially after that big introduction, I'm feeling I don't know how to get my head out the door after this, but thank you very much. I'm very excited to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm so happy to finally get you on the show, and yes. also because we haven't talked since November. I saw you in Birmingham. I went to a conference, and Gore Blimey joined me, and we sat around and we looked at all the cute boys and listened to a lot of paper readings, and it was really very fun order, for us. Yeah. So anyway, it was a lot of fun, and we hung out. We had really amazing breakfasts at my hotel, and we talked about a lot of things. And the thing about Gore Blimey that's so great is that you are kind of – well, I guess you're just like Dan in a lot of ways, in that you are a pretty unsnobby cinephile, particularly when it comes to horror and B movies. Like, you watch a lot of everything, and
he does.
And we follow you, but it's like you're constantly like churning out all of these really great sort of indie horror movies, new and old, and then you tweet about them while you watch them so people can get a general idea of how you feel about the films. And it's a lot of fun to see that. And there's also a lot of double entendres, which may happen tonight. I'm not sure.
Yeah, apparently there are. I never really know about them. I think people tell me afterwards. I said something that was really dirty, which completely went over my head. But I mean, with movies, especially horror movies, I think you can appreciate them on different levels. So you've got the ones that are really good and really scary or really good stories. But then you've also got the ones that try really hard and don't quite make it. And they're a lot of fun as well, I think. I mean, the only kind of horror films I don't enjoy are the ones that are just boring, you know. So, I mean, a film doesn't have to be, like, a good film, in inverted commas, to be enjoyable, you know. I mean, I've got big love, as we know, for Zombie Lake, and it's a terrible film, but it's entertaining, you know. And there's so many films like that. So, so I enjoy all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit just real quick about, so you had a guest, and I can never remember her name. It's Nico. What's her last name?
Oh, yes, Nico Vaughn. Yes, that's right.
Yeah, I would highly recommend that. Well, there's a couple episodes I recommend, but I would recommend the one with Nico because you guys talk about shark movies, and she says a lot of really interesting things about, like, Sharknado versus, like, the older shark movies that I found really interesting, and she's like-minded with you, I think, in the way she approaches these films. And it was a really interesting discussion. And also it was shark movies, which was amazing.
Yeah. she's written a book about that kind of film. I mean, she's also she set up the Bad Film Club, which is over in the UK, especially around Cardiff area, where her and a friend of hers, they screen a movie, a bad movie, and do a live commentary through it. And she's been doing that for quite a few years now. And I kind of know her through that. And so, yeah, she's a lot of fun. She knows a lot about movies, especially the bad kind, and especially shark movies. That's a particular passion of hers. So, she was a great guest. She's, really funny.
Yeah, but she approaches everything like, is there heart in the film? And if there's heart in the film, then you can extend yourself to it. And I really liked listening to that, and it kind of warmed me because that's how I also like to watch films. But you also had probably the best episodes I think you've done thus far were the ones where you had Eric Threefall from The Hysteria Continues come on, and you covered Friday the 13th you covered all the Friday the 13th in two parts. And
now the first four we covered. The first four.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Oops. Oh, that's your how much I'm paying attention. But yes, and you did in two parts, and it was really, really a great listen and a lot of fun. And that's what you do. You come on, and your podcasts are very light, but you also divvy out a lot of information about things. I kind of like to think that maybe we're a sister podcast to you in that way. And if anybody out there hasn't listened to Trilogy of Terror, I suggest you plug in now and download some episodes and check them out. They're all very good episodes. I'm just throwing out the ones that I remember that I really, really enjoyed. The Lamberto Bava one was really good too for me because you really kind of re-sparked my love of Lamberto Bava with that one. And I've been really obsessed with him ever since I listened to that episode because I watched the movie so I could send you some feedback. And I kind of forgot how much I really like him as a filmmaker. And so ever since then, I've been like trying to figure out how I can write an academic paper on him to do at a conference and things like that. So, he's a fascinating filmmaker.
He was a really easy choice for a first episode for me because Demons is one of my favorite 80s Italian horror films. It's just such a lot of fun. I mean, not only because it's got some great special effects and it's just it's got some great scary moments as well in it, but it's also got the sort of bizarre ridiculousness of things like from nowhere a helicopter drops through the roof and you know, and this kind of strange silliness that's in it as well. But it's an amazing film. So I mean, that was a really easy choice to pick as the first one, but it was also interesting for me to get to see some of his other films that I hadn't seen before. You know, so that was quite, I mean, that's part of the reason behind picking one director and looking at their work, is that it's also an opportunity for me to try and learn a bit about them and about what other things they've done.
Yeah, the Photos of Goya one is one that I had actually seen before, but I rewatched it. And that's a really interesting, talk about things happening for no reason, like the fever dream sequences of the murders with the giant eyeball head and everything. It's really evocative and interesting, and it's a really interesting, I think he's an interesting filmmaker, so I'll just leave it at that. That's for another podcast, I think. But anyway, everybody check out Trilogy of Terror. Yes. So I'm so happy that he's here, because we are going to talk a little bit about the British airings of Goliath Awaits. Not too much, but I wish I'd written down some more of the numbers, because maybe you could help me sort of suss out how you guys do your ratings, and maybe I'll talk about that when we get to that point. But before we get started, I just want to do a very brief bit of housekeeping here at the beginning while we still have our listeners all here. So we were nominated again for a Rondo Award. We were nominated last year for what's called Best Multimedia Site, which is basically podcasts or websites that have a lot of interactivity, I guess. And there's a huge amount of people on the list this year, including The Stereo Continues, which I'm really excited about. They well-deserved. And I was also nominated for Best Commentary for Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, which came out through Warner Archives. Yay, thank you. And I'm really excited about that for a couple different reasons. One, because that's a great TV movie, and it was nice to see it get nominated. Yeah. But secondly, it was a solo commentary, and those are still really kind of scary for me, and it was kind of nice to see it get recognized. So I'm really excited about that. So I'll just tell you, last year when we got nominated, we were so beside ourselves with excitement that we did a very special episode where we each picked an episode that we really liked that we thought would make a good introduction to our show. So if you're just tuning into us for the first time, try to go back through our archives and find that episode. I guess it came out approximately a year ago. And it's not very long. And we all just sort of guide you to episodes we think are of note from the, I guess we've done about 50 episodes now. So check that out. I will tell you, voting ends on March 29th. So just Google Rondo Awards. I think it might be rondoaward.com is the URL. And you can email your picks to taraco@aol.com. So that's taraco@aol.com. And just do it by March 29th. And just vote with your heart. Obviously, you don't have to vote for us, but it's great if you do send in some ballot about something. It's really neat to be recognized for things. And it's a pretty prestigious award in the horror community, so we don't take it lightly. And we're very excited. And that's all I'm going to say about it. I'm not going to shove it down anybody's throats. Oh, go ahead, Dan.
May I say something? I did notice that on the award sort of ballot thing, they say, like with your commentary, they say it's not specific. It's that commentary is what you were specifically voted on there for, but you can also treat it as like looking at the person's work over the year kind of thing. So not just including that, you can say like, we are giving Amanda Reyes this exciting award kind of thing, not just specifically for the one commentary. It says that somewhere on the ballot. So because there are so many on there, and there's so many folks like yourself who do a lot of these, and it's sort of this au revoir, is that a word? You know, sort of this big thing, you know, and you sort of, it covers everything as far as I know, not just that, but if you love that one, and I think it's one of your best commentaries.
Thank you.
I think, vote for Amanda. It's a vote for the world. It's a vote for freedom.
Yeah, in the election year, this is very important, guys. Make sure you make your right choices. But so anyway, thank you very much. But let's dive into Goliath Awaits.
40 years ago, a Nazi sub sank the world's largest ocean liner. Now, in 1981, in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, 1,000 feet down, a diver makes a chilling discovery.
There's somebody looking out at me. It's a girl. Oh, my God. She's alive.
The Goliath. After 40 years on the ocean floor, why are they still alive? Watch Goliath Awaits. Wednesday night at 8, only on Channel 11.
So I will say, I'm going to try to keep this as simple as possible. This was two-hour parts, a total of like 3 hours and 12 minutes long. Now, I know what you're saying. Guys, you do two movies generally that are about that long, but they're separate movies, and it's easier to cover and such. And this has like a cast of thousands. Well, cast of many dozens. So let me, I'm going to try to keep on top of the names as best I can. But so we start, it's during World War II. There is a British vessel ship called the Goliath, which has 3,000 passengers on it. It's a huge ship going, I believe, across the Atlantic. Well, where else would it be going, I guess, if it's going for Britain? So it's going across the Atlantic, and on board you see all – it's very Titanic-esque, which I may have given something away there. And you see all these people on board, and you meet the young engineer John McKenzie, played by 60-year-old Christopher Lee, which is fun. But you meet McKenzie, who is very sort of a well-respected engineer on the ship, and then you meet a man named Dan Wesker, played by Frank Gorshin, doing an accent that I ain't going to wander near, but I think it's meant to be Irish. I mean, I could say Faith and Begorra, like, really loud or something like that, but I ain't going to. Maybe later. Maybe later we will. And McKenzie has a brief chat with Wesker, and you learn sort of that Wesker was some kind of criminal that McKenzie has given a break to and allowed him to work on the ship. And then almost immediately, Nazis torpedo the ship and it sinks. And we cut from 1940-ish to 1981. And the SS Mark Harmon, I forget what the name of the ship is that they're traveling on. Mark Harmon is on there, and he has a great mustache. And his sort of second – he's on a salvage ship. They are looking for like – they said like magnesium or manganese or – they're looking for something or other. Molybdenum, I don't know, some sort of metal or element out in the middle. Oh, yes?
Real quick, just because now that you said that, I didn't make a note of it, but we should mention that on this ship is Kip Niven, the star of New Year's Eve, right?
Yes, I was just about to say his second in command is the killer from New Year's Evil, and his engineer is Roz Kelly. I'm kidding, but the guy from New Year's Evil is on there, and they find the Goliath. And so they decide to, although it's not on their sort of purview, as it were, they go down and they check it out. It's the Goliath. It's bound to have stuff on it. And what ends up happening is Mark Harmon's character, who's Peter Cabot, and I'm going to alternate between calling him Mark Harmon and Cabot throughout this. But Mark Harmon hears a tapping, and as he approaches the Goliath, the sunken Goliath, which is 1,000 feet down, he hears that someone is tapping SOS, and it seems to be coming from within the ship. And he looks through a porthole, sees what looks to be a light emanating from inside, and then he sees a lovely young lady slowly approach the porthole from within the sunken ship. And then he has kind of like a spazzy moment, and he winds mm-hmm. up sort of by a pool, kind of convalescing a little bit later. And he sticks by what he heard the SOS, he saw a light, and he saw a young woman inside the ship. And he's talking to Admiral Sloan, played by the great Eddie Albert. Hooray! And talking to Commander Jeff Selkirk, played by Robert Forster. Hooray! So it's this fun scene where it's Eddie Albert talking to Robert Forster, talking to Mark Harmon.
I am certain that I was quite lucid when I saw what I saw and I heard what I heard. Listen, all I'm asking is that someone with the proper capabilities and hardware go out there and investigate. Look, if I'm wrong, you can lock me up and throw away the key.
And if I were to give you the okay and you were wrong, they'd lock me up too, only my cell would be padded. Commander, your salvage officer, what'll it take to do this job?
Well, for openers, sir, we might toss Mr. Cabot here in a straitjacket.
I mean in the way of equipment.
Yes, sir. Our most sophisticated vessel is the Point Loma, sir, but she's in dry dock and couldn't be made available for at least a month, sir.
Any other solution?
Well, if the Admiral's really serious about pursuing this charade...
I am serious, mister. And I expect a direct answer to my question, not a personal observation.
Yes, sir.
And they're basically discussing what he saw, and Selkirk and Cabot have a history together involving, like... I won't go too into it, but like Cabot, I guess, kind of ignored some orders in order to help Selkirk get out of something, and Selkirk kind of turned him in, even though Cabot saved his life, and et cetera, et cetera. This will come back later on, much later on. But and so Selkirk is very no-nonsense, as you would expect from Robert Forster. He's very no-nonsense, whereas Mark Harmon's character is very much like, come on, I want to go. I saw a lady. She was cute. I got this mustache. Let's do it. Let's check it out. Come on. Be awesome. And Admiral Sloan says, okay, I want you to take a ship. They got a British ship they can take out there. And then we learn Admiral Sloan takes Robert Forster aside and says, I loved you in Alligator. Can I have your autograph? He doesn't say that. But what he says is, you need to go down there because there was a Senator Bartholomew on board. And Senator Bartholomew had a diplomatic pouch from the British to FDR directly. and we've learned that the information is pretty volatile in the pouch, and it was actually written by two Nazi spies, so it's false. But he says something which I didn't fully get, but I understand where they were going, where he said, and so if someone were to get a hold of that and leak that to the world, it would be problematic, and we wouldn't be able to prove that it was falsified anymore.
Right.
I'm not 100% sure how that works, but so it's basically Sloan has kind of his own thing, like, okay, you know, Mark Harmon might be a bit doolally, but we are going to send you down there to check it out and find that pouch and destroy it. So they send a bunch of people down there, and they've got a crew. They've got a doctor there. They've got Cliff from Cheers is there, which is awesome.
Yes.
He was just in the director's, Kevin Connor's Motel Hell.
That's
the
right.
Year before. So I guess that's one of his favorites, is Mr. Ratzenberger. And they go down there, and they approach the Goliath. And the whole time, Robert Forster's character is very much like, this is a waste of time. Well, he knows he has to go in for the pouch, but he's like, this is a waste of time. There's no one down there, etc. And Mark Harmon is like, trust me, I'm Mark Harmon. And they get right down by the boat. And there's a great moment. There's the guy, the pilot of like the little ship thing that they land is named Dave. And so they get up close and they hear the SOS. They actually hear it. And Mark Harmon's character taps back, and they get a message back from the inside of the Goliath. It's something along the lines of Goliath awaits 300, you know, implying that there are 300 survivors. And then it's something like air toxic, beware. And then it taps out the name Mackenzie.
They must have heard us. Why else would they stop the SOS? This is PC 18. Respond.
They got a knack for rhythm, Peter. See if they answer the bongo serenade.
Damn, answering. Answering! Here. Goliath. On board 3-3-7. Danger. Air toxic. Beware. Proper name, Mackenzie.
And it's like, oh, Christopher Lee is still alive. The young Mackenzie is alive. So he's 102. And then they send two divers in to investigate. The divers make it into a space where there is an air bubble inside the ship. I'm trying to figure out where to wrap this up, because you see the two divers kind of rise up out of the water. And I forget, they're in some sort of room that might be like a pool or something. I forget what it is. And they look around the room, and standing on like a ledge sort of on the floor out of the water are a bunch of guys, and they immediately shoot the divers. We cut to a little bit later, and Admiral Sloan is giving a press conference, and it's a great press conference because he sort of does that thing where it's like, yes, you, okay, and you, yes, and you, oh, Gene, how are you? And that, yes, you, yes, and it's a fun conference, and you learn that they are going to send a diving – there's a lot of scientific stuff which may or may not be real science about how they have to depressurize and pressurize, and they have to adapt a crew to the air that's in the ship because they've been recycling air for 40 years. And they basically send down our main guys. They send down Mark Harmon and Robert Forster and John Ratzenberger and that doctor guy, and they're all sent down into the ship. And they have all sorts of like depressurizing cabins and things all over the place because they're going to bring the 300 people up, and they have to obviously from 1,000 feet underwater, they have to be adjusted so they don't get the bends and their bodies don't, I guess, explode or something. And so they basically head into the ship, arrive at the exact same spot where the previous divers arrived, and they meet everybody. And there's a crew there led by Mr. McKenzie. Frank Gorshin is there, continuing to do that accent, whatever it is. We meet Christopher Lee's, John McKenzie's daughter, Leah? Who's Emma Sams. And we sort of realize that there are 300 people living there. They've been there for 40 years, and they're surviving. And there's lots of explanation of how they survive and things like that. And people seem to be happy, and McKenzie is almost like a living god, sort of. Everyone's like, oh, Mr. McKenzie's done this, Mr. McKenzie's done that. And Dan Wesker's character is kind of – no one really seems to like him, but McKenzie kind of keeps him on as – well, we'll talk about his character. Well, I'm going to wrap this up here, but basically the gang, Selkirk and Cabot and Cliff show up and they say, hey, we want to save your people. We want to rescue your people, bring them up to the surface. And some people are excited. Some people are a little iffy on that. And because they sort of, it looks like a utopia, although we learned very quickly that there are sort of pirate-esque people who live in the who live sort of in the bowels of the ship and kind of break in and try. They're sort of described as people who have tried to break out of the ship and have been affected by the bends. So they're sort of broken and deformed, apart from the main guy, who's a super hunk. And
that's right. Duncan Rieger.
Yes. And so I'll kind of leave it there because Selkirk is very no-nonsense and says, we've got it set up. We want to get your people out of here. And McKenzie is kind of – We'll discuss how it is. I'll just say that everything isn't quite as great as McKenzie's utopia would lead you to believe, and a lot of things happen. At this point, we're about an hour into the 3-hour and 12-minute long thing, so I'm going to stop there because I could go on for another 20 minutes. But that's the basics of Goliath. It starts off like a disaster film, and then it becomes very much like one of Kevin Connor's films with Doug McClure from the 70s, where they find a Jules Verne-esque civilization, and then it shifts and moves about. But I will stop there.
That's a pretty good breakdown, and it's amazing how long it takes to kind of unfold that. But it happens in a way; it happens very quickly, and in a way, they really take their time with showing how they get underwater and into the boat. So I want to get your opinions of the film first before we dive into the story. So I've seen Goliath Awaits 3 times. This is my 3rd time watching it. I love it every time I watch it. I always think, okay, I'll watch this in 2 parts. But then I always end up sitting there for 3 hours and 15 minutes and just glued to the TV because I'm really just fascinated by this little world that was created by the filmmakers. And but since I've seen it 3 times, and I'm not that interesting to talk to. So let's look at the opinions of the other 2 people who've seen. I think this is a first-time viewing for both of you.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm really excited to hear your thoughts. So let's go ahead and start with Dan. Dan, what did you think of Goliath Awaits?
I quite liked it, and I was actually going to say what you just said, which is when I watched it, I tried to watch it the way it originally aired. So when I sat down to watch it, I watched it in a version that was all strung together, so there were no opening closing credits in between 1 and 2. You can tell the moment when 1 ends; it's very obvious and very sad too. But what ended up happening was about a week ago, I sat down and was like, okay, I'm going to watch the first half, then tomorrow I'm going to watch the second half. But I actually think this is one that works better if you just treat it as a movie that is the length of like Titanic or Shortcuts, you know, or Avengers Endgame or something. You know, if you just treat it as a very long movie, it actually works better. Because I think if I had taken a day off in between Part 1 and Part 2, I don't think it would have had the same gravitas. No, that's not quite right. Well, maybe that's right with Mark Harmon and his mustache and getting more histrionic as he goes. I think it works better if you watch it all at once, set aside the time and do that, because I watched it twice for this. I was able to sneak in a second viewing, and I just think it looks like it's structured to be watched all at once. It doesn't feel like the break at the end of Part 1 is fine, but watch it all at once. Having said that, I really enjoyed it. I love the way that it begins very much in a vein of like Raise the Titanic or Beyond the Poseidon Adventure, where it's sort of, I don't know if you call those post-disaster disaster films, where there's been a disaster and now we're going to go and check it out. And like in Beyond the Poseidon Adventure, you know, Michael Caine and Sally Field and Telly Savalas end up getting involved in that disaster. The first 40, 45 minutes of this are sort of excavating the sunken ship, as it were. But then about an hour in, when they discover the society, for about an hour and a half, I'm so sorry, everyone, I've got my throat. For about an hour and a half, it becomes, like I said, sort of very much like almost a Jules Verne-esque. I was surprised Doug McClure wasn't in it.
Yeah.
It's a Kevin Connor film. That confused me, because I always love some Doug McClure.
Yes. But,
well, he was making Humanoids from the Deep maybe around this time or something.
Yeah. So Emma
he
could, Sams,
Oh, yeah, yeah. that's right. But and so for about an hour and a half, it becomes you see this world, and it's very much one of those, like, we've discovered this lost world, and you learn how it works, and you learn what happens, and you learn that maybe it's not as beatific, utopia-ish as you think it is. And then it's great because as you sort of see this world kind of beginning to fall apart, it becomes a like Airport 77 style disaster film again, where everything's falling apart. Now we have to get as many people out as we can before it all, you know, it goes to pieces. And there's so much going on. And like just to the point where you're like, how can something else, what else could happen? John Carradine shows up and you're like, what? I forgot he was in the credit. You know, it's just, it's a lot of fun. And I think it's got a really nice flow to it. And I mean, there are bits here and there, like some of the stuff between Robert Forster and Mark Harmon. I don't want to say it felt forced, but it was like, okay, we get it. They have to have this sort of bit of antagonistic kind of thing, but I could have done without that. But most of it, and I could have, to be honest, Frank Gorshin really took me out of the movie at times. The thing is, I love the Riddler. He's a fantastic Riddler. Oh my gosh, he's so good. But it's just that he alternates between being like very sinister. He's very sinister when the camera is just looking at him and you see his face. The moment he starts talking, he kind of would take me out of the film, unfortunately. Now, not that it's bad. He's not there all the time. He's just kind of sort of on the edges of the movie a lot of the times. But
the accent reminds me a lot of the Leprechaun. It reminds me of that, but not as good as Leprechaun.
Yes.
Oh, my God. Am I going to have to defend Frank Gorshin?
I like the concept of the character, although there was one thing I'll say this now in case I forget it, because one of the things with the characters that Mackenzie kind of uses him as his kind of tough guy, strong arm guy, kind of, but sort of casually. And sometimes he doesn't even realize that Frank Gorshin's character is doing some of the things he's doing. But the weird thing is, it's kind of mentioned, you know, like, well, he was this criminal and he was wanted for something, and Mackenzie brought him on board the ship and gave him a chance, and now he's his right hand man. But it almost implies that Mackenzie brought him on board the ship back in the 40s because he knew they were going to sink and they were going to wind up on the ship for 40 years. So he'd need this guy by his side. That's almost
smart.
Yes, that's almost the way I thought about it. It's like, that's really planning ahead. You know, we might get sunk and there might be an air bubble. I'm going to bring this guy on who will do anything for me because I gave him a chance.
Apart from a good Irish accent. Yeah,
apart from a good Irish accent. Maybe he's not Irish. He's a fugitive on the run. You know,
that's right.
So, but yeah, I think the movie, it you know, it has its faults here and there, but generally it moves really nicely, and it's got so many characters and it's got so much going on that most of the things I saw that I was like, I'm iffy on, came in the second viewing, and I don't think most people will watch it more than once. So I recommend it quite a bit. I thought it was a joy.
Well, what did you think of Alex Cord's accent as Dr. Sam Marlowe? Because he was like straight up plantation owning, like, my darling.
Surely you don't think we'd do anything without his permission.
Like, I can't even do it. Like, it's just his accent. And I love Alex Cord, but like, that is the accent where I'm like, and speaking of accents, it's interesting because, so a lot of the survivors of the Goliath, well, they're not really survivors of the Goliath. They came after they were born, right? Yeah. And on the ship, and then they grew up on the Goliath. So we have two characters. We have Maria, and we have Emma Sam's character, who I think you said was Leah. I'm totally forgetting her name now. And it's interesting. So Christopher Lee's British, right, and his daughter has a British accent. Yeah. But Laurie Lathien's character, Maria, came from Americans, and she has an American accent. And I don't understand how they have accents as at all.
Yeah,
you know,
it's
like
not a genetic
thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really funny how that happened. There was no consistency in like the accents at all, and with the exception of Robert Forster, who's from Chicago or something. It sounds like it, but that's really about it.
And I did notice too that there's a high proportion of final girls who apparently were ancestors of the originals, because folks on there, because you get Laurie Lathien, and then you get the final girl from Don't Open Till Christmas. I guess she's kind of the final. She's not quite the final girl. She's the lead gal who's I forget the actress's name, but you know her. You know what I'm talking about.
Wait, the girl from Don't Open Till Christmas is in this movie?
Not the one who the killer kidnaps, the one who's in Slaughter High, not that one, the other one whose dad gets killed at the beginning.
Oh, my God. I didn't realize.
Yeah, they have the daughter, like the six-year-old daughter.
Yes.
And, yeah. And the.
Oh, my God. Yes, I totally see her now in my head, and I recognize. I didn't realize that she had actually was an actress of any kind of note, because being in Don't Open Till Christmas is of note, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. But, because that's really amazing. I didn't know that. Okay, Gore Blimey, why don't you tell us what you thought of Goliath Awaits?
Shall I start with my favorite bit of all?
Yes.
My favorite bit, I mean, this is above Mark Harmon, of course, is Mark Harmon's trousers. I mean, those were so tight. I mean, you could see all his lunchbox. And believe you me, there were quite a few meat products in there. Yes, it was... almost as distracting as the Irish accent. But now he's... Because there's a scene at the beginning, which Dan mentioned, when he's by this pool, and I think it's a naval hospital, so presumably he's getting something done to his belly button or something. But he... the Admiral guy comes over, and at one point he says to him, "I can see your candor." And I thought, well, so could all of us with those trousers on. But... he's great in there. I mean, he steals the show for me. And there's a scene where we hear him, somebody mentions that Mark Harmon is going to be penetrating the torpedo hole. And to be honest, I had to go and lie down for a bit when I heard that. it's a really fun movie. I enjoyed it. It's something you need to suspend quite a lot of disbelief for.
Yes, for sure.
I mean, you know, it starts off with things like, for example, you've got Christopher Lee wearing the exact same uniform he was wearing 40 years ago in pristine condition, still fits and everything. So a little bit zombie-like there. And you've got Emma Sams in full makeup and all the rest of it, which is kind of a little bit, you know. But then, you know, I watch a lot of horror movies, so I'm not really someone in a position to criticise how real a film is. I mean, in terms of the actors, I think, for me, Jean Marsh is the one, the best performance for me.
Yeah.
I thought she was amazing.
Oh, I loved Jean Marsh.
I mean, she had a role which could have been a very bland, forgettable character, and a very unlikable character, but she actually brings life to it, and she makes her sympathetic, you know, despite everything. And I think that was great. And I don't know how well known she's over with you. She was over here. She's more famous for a series we had called Upstairs Downstairs.
Yes.
That's right. Well, she co-created.
That's right.
Which I didn't know.
She also did The House of Elliot, which was another costume drama that was really big over here, which she co-created as well. She's absolutely great. And I mean, of course, Christopher Lee was great, but then I wouldn't have expected anything less from him. I thought he was great. He's got such a presence, you know. I mean, his voice, the way he looks. I mean, you know, you said he was 60 or something. He looks very good for his age. Yeah. And he has this stature. I think he's about 6'5" or something, you know, so he towers above even the 6 foot actors in this. You know, he's got a really big presence. We've also got, as far as actors go, there's Mark Harmon, of course, and he has a whole sequence in the film in the sub where he's completely shirtless and very sweaty. So, I mean, and his acting, I mean, who cares? It's all right, I suppose. It's good, I think. I don't know. But the moustache is a bit off-putting. I mean, it sort of looks a bit like someone sort of asked him to smell this hamster and then he kind of forgot to exhale afterwards or something. It's a bit, weird.
It. But I had glue under my nose. Oh, no!
His character is also, he's supposedly quite likable and heroic, but he's, I found him a bit creepy in a couple of places. Because there's one scene where he barely met Emma Sam's character and he's kind of launching his face onto hers and snogging her and stuff. And then in a later scene, he's talking, they're calling him Romeo and he's talking about, you know, getting married and all. And the poor girl's sitting there and it's like, does she get a say in this or anything? And it was a little bit creepy. She's supposed to be 17 or something.
Well, it was off-putting because the scene where he kisses her is right after Maria dies.
Mm. Yes.
And she's mourning the loss of her friend and he comes to comfort her and then he starts making out with her. And I'm like, I don't know if this is the right time.
This is a bit. But anyway, I mean, the weakest link for me with all this, as you've said, is the Wesker, the Irish guy. Because he says at one point, he says, when I was in Dublin, and I thought, you've never been to Dublin in your life. I don't think you know where to point to it on a map. But that was really, like Dan was saying, I found that very distracting. Every time he spoke, it really took me out of it because I was just thinking, oh, that's awful, that accent. So, and talking of other accents that find it a little bit grating, and this is nobody's fault, this is when they were playing their music, it's just a pet hate of mine. They had all these old records with songs sung in that 1940s clipped British accent that you... Happy days are here again and do the Lambeth walk. Oi. And it's just, it really grates with me. It's very brief encounter. Yeah, oi. It's very brief encounter. That's just a pet hate of mine. I agree with Dan as well. I got in my notes I'd made that it reminded me of those Doug McClure movies from the 70s, those sort of Warlords of Atlantis and At the Earth's Core. And also the 60s version of The Time Machine. It reminded me of those sort of...
Oh, sure, yeah.
Not because it has the monsters or the same story, but it's just that whole adventure feeling. And it also reminded me, I saw very recently a recent film called Snowpiercer, from 2013, with Chris Evans, who sadly isn't sweaty and shirtless through most of it. But it's got a very similar setup. It's got an isolated society. In this case, they're not under the sea there. It's post-apocalyptic, so they're the only survivors. And they're in a confined area, but it's in a train instead of a ship. And there's a man in charge who's a bit godlike, sort of. He thinks he's a bit godlike and has no qualms of killing people and stuff. And you've got the people at the back of the train, which are like the bow people in this, the sort of underclass that don't kind of fit in.
Yes.
So there's a lot of similarities that was quite interesting to compare the two with, you know, the same setup. But it's quite long with the 3 hours, but actually it goes along at a really good pace, and I thought that was quite good. And if it does start to get a bit slow, they just chuck in another shirtless man. There's quite a few of them thrown in there. There's no female nude, but there's a lot of shirtless men in there. There's that. Emma Sams, the only thing with Emma Sams is there's a climactic scene where she's being rescued and she kind of turns into a bit of a sack of potatoes and is a bit of a liability and keeps fainting and passing out and having to stop and catch her breath or get carried, and then she takes forever and ever trying to put the protective gear on and stuff. And I got to be honest, at those points I was yelling at the screen for him to just leave her behind. Is that a bit mean?
I think at that point in the movie it has become like a disaster film again. And so you have to have a character who does that, but her character, it seems, doesn't seem quite right. So it's sort of like, come on, just get it moving.
The thing, I mean, I overall, I mean, it sounds like I picked out a lot of things that were kind of fun and laughing at it, which I did admit there were bits that, you know, amused me in it. But overall, I found it was like a really fun sort of an action movie, like an adventure movie. I mean, the only thing that was slightly uncomfortable to watch for me is it's the whole thing just seemed to turn into a metaphor. You know, you've got this society in a bubble that are playing out their 40-year-old music and fashions, don't want to be part of the wider society because of fear and lack of knowledge, who follow every word their delusional leader with a god complex says, and they're fed lies, misinformation, fear of outsiders, blissfully unaware that they're people, you know, being killed off, and ignoring the advice of all the experts and scientists, and at the same time it's their leader that's doing all the things that's killing them off. And so, and that was kind of a bit that, that seems a bit, watching it in 2020 was quite uncomfortable. Yeah. Whichever side of the continent you're on, it seems, you know, of the world you're on, it seems a bit uncomfortable. But no, overall, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was loads of fun. Went by really quickly, and although it was over 3 hours long, it didn't feel like that at all. No, I thought it was loads of fun. It was a good pick. So thank you.
Oh, good. Good. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I guess what I'll start here is that Gore Blimey brought up a couple of interesting things, and I didn't write them down, so I'm trying to do these off memory. But the thing that you mentioned that I wanted to point out was Jean Marsh and Christopher Lee, I think, are both interesting characters in that even though I think Christopher Lee has a very dark side to his character, I found them both to be sort of tragic. And Jean Marsh in particular. And she won my heart because... So like the people who have come from the top of the earth into the water and down into the Goliath, they come and they're being kind of toured around and they're being treated fairly well and they're being shown. There's this really great sequence where they get kind of like a tour and you see everything sort of in this green glow, and that's because everything's sort of phosphorus from the seaweed and everything, and the way the engineer turned God, right? Christopher Lee's character, Mackenzie, has turned all of the stuff from the ocean to sustainable things so that they could live off them, and it's kind of to see it all set up. But anyway, Christopher Lee goes ahead and he splits off the doctor. Dr. Sam Marlowe is Alex Cord's character, and he hooks him up with Jean Marsh, who's Dr. Goldman. Goldman is the important word here because she's Jewish, and she was born, I think, during the war. She was a little girl because she was on the ship when it sank, and it's important because they kind of bring it up later because she looks the other way when terrible things are happening, but she was a Jewish person who was the victim of so much stuff happening on the top side, right? And so it's kind of interesting. So her character is very conflicted and complicated, but she's also really, really tragic. So one of my favorite scenes in the movie is when she's showing Alex Cord's character around. She's never been in a relationship with a person. She decided that being a doctor, her father was a doctor and he trained her, and she becomes the doctor of the ship after the ship sinks. And her whole life has been her career, and never to like think about getting involved or having children or anything like that. But you could tell it's something that's been inside of her that's missing. And so casually, while getting to know her, Marlo asks, have you ever been married? And, or do you have any children, right? Is that what he says? And she says, no. And she asks him, and he says, yes, I have 3 children and I'm married. And you could see this look on her face, Jean Marsh's character, that she's so crestfallen that he's married because they have this chemistry.
Seems that Goliath has more than its share of brilliant men.
You're thinking about Mr. Mackenzie.
From whom all blessings flow.
You know, I have a great curiosity about your world. I can't imagine what it's like at all in spite of everything we've been taught about it.
Well, it might disappoint you, but I hope not.
Do you have much illness there?
Yes. There are many enemies we haven't conquered yet. There's cancer, the common cold.
Oh, we don't have anything like that here.
No illness at all?
Oh, minor complaints, of course. But our isolation has protected us. In the beginning, many died. But now we have a strong population with natural resistance.
Which reminds me the reason I'm here, aside from your charming company, of course. We brought along some serum to inoculate the people against any viruses that we might introduce ourselves.
Does Mr. Mackenzie know about this?
Surely you don't think we'd do anything without his permission.
Of course not.
Are you married, Dr. Goldman?
No. No, I'm dedicated to my work. And Mr. Mackenzie thought I would be more valuable doing this. Are you?
Yes.
Oh. Children?
Three.
Oh.
You don't quite expect that response. You kind of expect him to say no, or, you know, my wife has passed or something like that. But when he says it, yeah, you could see it in her face. She's so good. Yeah.
Good. She's so amazing in this. And it rips your heart out because you see that she's had to give up so much to live this life. And she's done it in a way where she's sort of, like I said, looking the other way while these horrible things are happening. Because there's this disease, it's called Palmer's disease, right?
Yes.
That's going around the ship, which is, I say Palmer's disease in quotes, because what it actually is when somebody becomes feeble and they can't become a worker on the ship, or they get too old, or something happens, like they hurt themselves, like with Maria, and we can talk about that here in a second, they get quote-unquote Palmer's disease, and they somehow end up dead. And the body is instantly cremated, so she never does any autopsies on them. And so while it's so ironic that it just so happens that everybody who becomes less than useful on the ship dies of quote-unquote Palmer's disease, she never investigates it any further than that. And at the same time, she comes from a place where they're doing medical experiments, right, on Jews.
Yeah.
During the era that she would have been on the Goliath. So it's a really interesting, her character is full of so many layers, and so I'm so glad you mentioned it. And also the tragedy of we can talk about the end of the film, because she also has kind of a tragic end as well. And I think Christopher Lee is tragic as too, because I'm under the impression that he doesn't fully understand what Wesker is doing behind his back, if anything at all. Like, I don't really think he thinks that he's killing all these people. I think he's looking the other way, a lot like Goldman is. But I do think, in a way, he is fairly benevolent. And I do think he has a God complex, but I feel like there's a part of him that is really good. And it gets just torn apart, especially because for so long he had sustained the Goliath. But as we find out as the film progresses, he had created this sort of energy source from this volcano that they were sort of shifted on. And Mark Harmon's character had informed him that, oh, we already did that like years ago. We tried to use that for an energy source and it doesn't work. And we had to scrap that. And so this thing that you've created was created 30 years ago, and it's going to basically kill everybody on your ship. And so he's come to the end of his sort of creative, benevolent, godlike sort of world, because now he can't go any farther than that, and his people are in true jeopardy. But he is so kind of used to being the guy that solves all the problems that he can't actually face the devastation that lays ahead of him. So he puts up, it's all about putting up blinders, isn't it? Right.
Yeah.
So like, and it makes him very tragic to me, because he was the third engineer. He wasn't that high up, but he survived, and he was able to sustain this life for 4 decades for his people. And then he couldn't do it anymore. And so my heart kind of felt for him, even though I think at the same time he was also not the greatest guy in the world. And I'm going to defend Wesker here, because I think Frank Gorshin is absolutely terrifying in this film. And some of the stuff he does, so maybe his accent is not perfect, but some of the stuff that I think Wesker does that's really amazing is, you notice he doesn't give a lot of eye contact. He's always talking to Christopher Lee and looking ahead. There's something wrong with him, and it's clear. And there's something really menacing about him, but it's also like he can't be a part of the society. So he lives on the outside of it, but he thinks he's doing these great things for his leader because he owes him, because he gave him a second chance. And so there's something about the performance that I find really intriguing. And he does freak me out in certain parts because he's very cold-hearted. And so when the first two guys come up to check out the Goliath and they get shot, there's this really great camera shot where you see it through their scuba mask, right? He comes up and it's the point of view of what the guy's seeing through the scuba mask. And he can't really see what's happening because there's still water over the mask. And so he just sees this group of people. And then there's a gunshot. And then the mask shatters. And then blood splatters onto it, you know? And it's just scary. And you can kind of tell it's Wesker, right? But, like, he has no idea what's happened to him. And both those guys die. And everybody just assumes that they couldn't make it to the ship and something happened and they died en route and not actually on the ship. And it's really dark, right, what happened to them. Mm. And so the Goliath awaits. What it does so beautifully, I think, is that it does create this really amazing universe that has a lot of beauty in it and a lot of darkness. And so, like, it has – so John Carradine is this actor who everybody, of course, thought had gone down with the ship. And Mark Harmon's like, oh, I used to watch you on the late movie all the time. And John Carradine loves this sort of virile actor that everybody thought he was. And then in reality, he's become this old man, this really sweet old man. But mm-hmm. like he talks about it at the end that he wants people to remember him as he was in the films, right? And so there's this, but he's also, he does these sword fights with the kids, and they show his old films. They have the reels of them there, and it's just really sweet stuff that happens. And they have, like, really funny moments. Like, there's this ongoing joke with John Ratzenberger really enjoying the food that they're eating in the Goliath, which is really gross. It's like octopus eyes.
Yes.
And, like, and really gross stuff. And there's this funny, he's always like, this chow here is really good, you know? And at the same time, it's marked with all this darkness, meaning basically everybody on the ship is sort of heading towards death. And there's all this conflict because of it. And so what Dan said about it being utopia that becomes a dystopia is really apt. And I think adds a lot of layers to the film. And also what Borblemi said about how much it sort of feels like 2020. This movie could have been made in 2020 because all the metaphors ring so true of what's happening today in England and in America. And so Goliath Awaits is doing all these different things that are really interesting to me. And I think you're right. It does have a very quick pace, and it balances the darkness and the light really well. And I love that it's so many amazing actors. So like one of the things I did when I started to make my notes was I just made a list of all the actors that had sizable parts. And the list goes on quite a ways, right? Because, mm-hmm. you know, you have everybody from Christopher Lee to John Carradine to Frank Gorshin to Robert Forster to Alex Cord to Eddie Albert to John McIntyre and Jeanette Nolan, who play the Bartholomews, to Gene Marsh, Duncan Rieger, Emma Sams, even Lori Lathien, you know? These are all, like, great names and faces that we all recognize. And they all are really good, you know, in it. And so it's just... so. You can watch it a number of different ways. Like you can watch it and be like, oh my God, look at all this stuff that's happening in the subtext. It's really fascinating. Or you could be like, oh my God, these are just all my favorite actors, you know, in this really great adventure story. Yeah. And so it walks that line really well. I think a movie that we talked about, and Frank Gorshin was in it, was Death Car on the Freeway.
Yeah.
And Death Car on the Freeway is a movie you can watch a couple different ways because it has a lot of subtext. It's really meaty and interesting to dive into, but it's also a really great movie with great car chases and car accidents and big explosions. And I think that Goliath Awaits does it as well. And I think some of the best TV movies are the movies that have managed to do that, so that you can think about the movie if you want, or you can just sit back and just admire the shirtless guys or, you know, the set design. Or, you know what I mean? Like, there's so much to enjoy about it. And so this is a movie I always really like to return to. And like I said, I've watched it 3 times. It's not one you watch over and over because it is so long, but it does have a rewatchability to it that I really enjoy. And not every movie has that, especially miniseries, you know, they're really hard to go back and watch over and over again. So this one does a really good job of it. So I guess we should talk a little bit about some of the stories that are happening. Cause I don't know if a lot of people listening have taken the time to watch the whole thing. And so, we might want to not walk them through it. But I will tell you that this came out on VHS, I don't know when, I guess in the 80s or 90s, in a truncated version. And they excised a couple of the subplots. And I think the one subplot that they took out was the one with the paper from the Nazis that was supposed to go to the States. And the way they chopped it up apparently makes it kind of incoherent, because I think there's portions of it have remained in to the edited version. And so if you read the reviews on Amazon for the VHS release, a lot of people were confused by the stories because they tried to cut it into a feature-length format. And so if you are interested in watching this movie, it's very important that you watch the 3-hour version, no matter how you find it. It did air on the Mystery Channel in its full form, which was an Encore station. And so that's the only way to really watch it. I've never seen the truncated version. I can't imagine it's very good. So I think Dan covered a lot of the subplots, but I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about Maria, because she's important to the story, but also the Bao people. We haven't really talked about them too much, and I think that they're really interesting. Duncan Rieger's character. And then maybe some more about Christopher Lee and what's happening on the ship, because there is so much happening. And it's interesting because while all of this is going on the Goliath, there is a lot of, like, cut to topside, right? Where we see what Eddie Albert's character, who is Admiral Wiley Sloan. Right. It's really interesting. So just briefly, one of the things I like about this movie is we clearly have a bad guy in this film, which is Wesker. But then we have some gray area bad guys, right? Like Goldman and Mackenzie. Yeah. But then we don't get a lot of antagonism from a lot of people, like you think you might. Like, for some reason, I was under the impression the first time I watched this that Eddie Albert's character was going to be a real sort of wrench in the machine, you know? Like, they were going to do something with him where he was going to prevent a lot of progress from happening because of that note or whatever. But he's actually very much, like, in it to win it. Like, once they realize, once Robert Forster phones him back and he's like, look, there's people on the ship and there's, like, 300 of them, and they're alive, and we need to bring them up. The Admiral goes all over the world to get these decompression chambers.
Yes.
And,
yes.
Yeah, they bring the world together to save all these people. And he's very much about, like, the care of the people that he sent down there and the care of the people that are left on the ship. And I love that. I love when you think a character's not going to be played out a certain way, when you're sure he's going to be the bad guy or something's going to happen with him, and he ends up being, like, playing along, you know, and being the good guy is always really nice. And Eddie Albert's great and everything. And he wears a lot of cardigans.
Yes. Really nice. The thing I love, too, is there's a great moment near the end where stuff is going on, and Robert Forster's character is like, okay, we're going to come up, you know, we're going to submerge in a, wait a minute, not, we're going to come up to the surface in a moment. You're going to come up now. Okay. Yeah. And yes, he's waiting for Mark Harmon and Emma Sams to show up. And he's like, you're going to come up now. You need to come up now. It has to happen right now. Okay, sir. We're going to come up right now. I'm sorry, sir. We can't hear you. You're breaking up. Oh, you can hear me just fine. You come
yes,
up.
Sir.
It's a great moment where he's doing that. I can't. You're breaking up, sir.
So this is Selkirk here. You all set, Jeff?
I'm in the PC-16, sir, but I'm waiting for Cabot and Leah.
Surface, Commander.
Sir, according to my calculations, we got at least a couple of minutes before we gotta get out of here.
That's cutting it too close. Surface.
Hey!
Watch it! Respond, Commander!
Sir, your transmission's garbled, sir. Repeat. I did not hear you.
You'll read me loud and clear. Surface.
But he's just at the other end going, he's like, I'm Eddie Albert. I know these shenanigans. Knock it off. And it's yeah, he's a fun character because, yeah, he starts off and he's going to, like, I like Eddie Albert. He has that, well, obviously, Green Acres is one of my favorite TV shows, but he's got that Eddie Albert sort of when he was in Columbo and he played the general or whatever it was in Columbo. He has this very authoritative thing, but he also can be taken down very easily, as you saw in Green Acres for six seasons. So I just love seeing him and stuff, and he's great. Like you said, you think briefly that he's going to go sort of mercenary on you and maybe do something unpleasant, but we don't have enough depression, compression, you know, we don't have enough chamber depression. We don't have enough chambers to fit all the people, sir. Well, go around the world. We'll get them. And it's just really lovely. Yeah.
Yeah, I really like watching all that stuff. So I think, I wrote a review of this in my book and I didn't go back and look at it, but I kind of think that a lot of that stuff with the, I don't know what they call them, submersiles or those little tiny submarines that go down. Yeah, those things. And also the big boats. I think some of that was stock footage or taken from something else. And the way the director, Kevin Connor, merges it is really beautiful because it looks very much a part of the film. But I think that whole, like, when we're watching them get set up to go under for the first time, and I think some of the topside stuff was taken from either other films or maybe Navy footage, something like that. There's some history to that footage. It's really interesting. And so we actually get to see what's happening above, too, although that's not a huge portion of the film, but I think it's kind of important because I do like the way it portrays the Admiral and kind of the people up there and how they're working. In a way, it's maybe very pro-patriotic, which it would have been in 1980 because we were right in the middle of that go, go, go America sort of vibe, and it sort of fits into that very well.
Yeah.
But then what's happening down below is that it's kind of a very soap opera-y. There's all these things that are happening between the characters, and there's a lot of dynamics and stories. And I really like the Bartholomews. So I just want to briefly mention that the actors who played them were John McIntyre and Jeanette Nolan. And you probably know those two actors if you look them up just by their face because they were in so many things. But you may not have known that they were actually a real-life married couple. And they appeared in a lot of stuff together as my married couple, which I really love. And of course, I can't think of anything offhand, but they did do a lot of stuff together. And they were really interesting to me, too, because so one of the things we find out later, as I mentioned, that if you become too sick or too old or too feeble, then you get Palmer's disease, right?
Yeah.
But these two characters were older and not working, and they got to stay. And I think this ties into Gore Blimey touching on the class systems.
yeah.
on the ship, which are very clear because he's a senator or a governor or something like that. And so it's interesting that they are sort of upheld in a certain way where a lot of other people on the ship aren't, that are younger than them even, right? And so they make for an interesting comparison to like a character like Maria. So Maria is Emma Sam's best friend. She's Leah's best friend. She's adorable, Florida Lathene. And she works in, is she part of the aquatic? I can't remember. There's all these different.
I forget.
It's almost like.
I can't remember. Yeah.
What do they call that when you're born in India? It's not a class system. It's a
caste system.
Caste system. You can't get out of it. You're born into that system, and then that's the job that you have for the rest of your life on the Goliath. So she has a certain job that her whole family apparently has, and so she grew up doing it. And while she's getting some stuff for her job, she's picking up vegetables, or I can't remember what it is now, but she ends up taking a tumble off this sort of high pillar. And just to just a brief mention, the stunt person, I know the stunt woman. It's interesting. I know Lori Lathene in real life, and I actually have a quote from her about this movie. I contacted her about it, and she gave me some information. But also, I know the stunt woman who does her stunt, which is hilarious. So her name is Marnine Fields, and that's the woman that's actually falling off the ledge. But it's interesting because I'm not really sure how injured she is, but she really tries to play it down for Mackenzie because he comes to visit her. And she's like, you know, I'll be walking tomorrow, so I'm okay. Mm. And you're not really sure if she's saying that or if she's really going to be okay. I don't think it's ever clarified.
How are you feeling?
Where's Mama?
I'm right here, darling.
What did Dr. Goldman say?
She can't walk, Mr. Mackenzie. It seems that the fall must have injured a nerve in some way, just temporarily.
I can walk tomorrow, Mr. Mackenzie. I promise.
Of course you will. We'll have you up and about on your feet in no time at all.
I can work in the aqua pools. I don't have to stand there.
We'll find some place, and don't you worry. As a matter of fact, Leah is going to look after you herself. Now, you'd like that, wouldn't you?
Yes.
Now, the next time I see you, I want to see a big, big smile. No more tears. All right?
Okay. You can tell she's scared, and I think everybody on the ship kind of knows what Palmer's disease really is, and she knows that if she doesn't get well soon, it's kind of the end for her. Mm. And I don't know that. I don't know that Mackenzie knows that.
It's, yeah, with the Wesker character, it's after a time, it's tough to tell what it is because Wesker shows up like almost immediately to take care of Lori Lathene's character, which seems she's young, you know, it's he's not a doctor, you know, he shows up very quick. He almost shows up to give us a cliffhanger at the end of part one, but I'm not going to say that.
Yeah, maybe. But you know, it's also something that Lori Lathene's character does that I really like is so he's approaching her, and she's obviously terrified, but she's calling out for her mom, and it's kind of this heart-wrenching moment, you know, where she kind of realizes what's happening, and she's powerless to do anything about it. And I thought it was really well done, and I thought he was really scary, and I just love that scene.
And she does kind of move. She doesn't move a lot, but she does kind of back away from him slightly. So I'm thinking, okay, so she can move. I don't know how her legs are working, but she can move. So it's not – maybe she's better than they think she is or yeah.
Yeah, I think it's an introduction to the fact that if you even for 10 seconds stop serving a purpose on the Goliath,
you
become an undesirable. And I'm guessing that a lot of the people that became the Bow people or Bow people, I guess they call them, may have been undesirable at some point and they needed to escape, right? And we don't know because we only know Duncan Rieger's character. And I don't know if he ever really clarifies how he becomes sort of the lead rebel of the ship.
Or what happened to his shirt is one of the things, because he seems to have an allergy to wearing one.
It's hilarious because when they take him
even
off,
in the end, yeah.
Yeah, in the end, when he comes up into the decompression chamber submarine thing, he's like got his shirt off. And I'm like, he's going to be in the decompression chamber for like 8 days like that. And I want to be in that chamber with him. Is that possible?
Whenever I saw him, I kept thinking of two things. Fresno, Gregory Harrison's character in Fresno, who's the mysterious man who always has his shirt off.
And the Zucker, Abram Zucker film, Top Secret, when Val Kilmer and the leading lady meet the head of the rebels, like the French rebels, and it's the super hunky guy with the oiled up chest and everything who never puts a shirt on. Well, no, I think he might later in the movie. But that's kind of what I thought of, this kind of great guy who's like, even in the end when everyone's running around, no one says, hey, man, do you want a shirt? No, I'm fine. Look at me. enjoy me. I am here for your enjoyment.
Sorry, I couldn't. His face, I don't think I could recognize him in a lineup if he had clothes on. Because I don't think I really got to see his face because your eyes are just drawn away. You know, wow.
Yeah.
He was really like slick and oiled like through the whole thing.
Oh, yes.
But like to go back to why I think he's kind of important too, he's sort of like Maria's character in a way, in that they capture him. So what I want to say is at the beginning when the Bo people or Bao people, I always want to say Bo people, when the Bao people first show up, I love it because it is very adventurous. They're like sliding off vines and stuff, you know, and it's like horns are playing or something, and it's very much like watching a 50s adventure or something. It's amazing. But when he gets captured and brought back over to the other side of the ship or whatever, they're like, okay, let's execute him. And it's so heartless, right? Like, he's just this young guy with this sort of political ideology that doesn't go along with you. And I don't know that they've really hurt anybody at this point, but, like, you're just going to execute him? And it's so... So in that way, Mackenzie is very cold-hearted, right?
Christopher Lee does something that I noticed the second time where he has his cap off when he's talking to Mr. Hunky. But the moment he says you're going to be executed, he puts the cap on, and that used to be the British thing when they would when there was a death sentence, it's not the death cap, I forget what it's called, but it was actually like a square cloth or something, and when they would say, you know, you're sentenced to death or by hanging or whatever, they would put this on their head, and so you knew that was you were dead. You know, that's how the death penalty was carried out. And there hasn't been the death penalty there for ages, but that's the way they used to. And I actually think that's, I know that from Monty Python. Yeah. The Monty Python episode where Graham Chapman makes a joke about how he's moving from England to South Africa because they still have the death penalty there. And they mentioned the, it was a nice moment because he has the cap off and he's talking to him. And then the moment he says you're going to be executed, he puts the hat on very like, I don't have the cap or whatever, but I'm going to put my hat. And I thought, oh, that's nice. That's a nice touch.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting that you bring that up because I'm starting to think of Mackenzie as somebody who's like living out a role and not necessarily being themselves. Do you know what I mean? Like he's doing things, but sometimes it feels like there's an act to them, you know, like when he goes to visit the children. And, like, there's something about him where he feels like I have to be this benevolent leader all the time. And sometimes you wonder if there's an actual Mackenzie inside of him or if it's just this role that he's playing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that kind of adds to that idea, for me anyway, about that. And I don't know if there's other stories we need to talk about, but I just thought the Bao people were really fun. So he gets saved from the execution and he gets to go back to his that he's leading, and we find out that Emma Sams is sort of this undercover rebel, right? That like she's torn between the love from her father, whom she respects greatly and believes that he's done wonderful things, but also that there are these people who haven't been heard that also deserve something too, right? And so she helps them when she can, and it's never clarified whether or not her and Riker had an affair. Mackenzie really tries really hard to lay out her innocence, right? To Harmon's character, and you're not quite sure if he's saying that for his own benefit or if that's a true thing, right? So we don't really know if Emma Sams has had this sort of affair with him or not, which I think is really interesting because she does come across as very innocent to me in a lot of ways. And I kind of believed Mackenzie when he said that, but at the same time, she goes above and beyond. But then at the end, it feels like she's going to end up with Mark Harmon, and Riker doesn't seem all that bent out of shape about it. So
yeah. Bent out of shape, is that like a Ben's kind of joke?
It is. That's my joke of the week. Yeah, that's my...
that sequence with the Bao people has one of my favorite moments in it regarding the SOS, and where you realize SOS came from, and that you realize that the last two words that were SOS'd at them, they kind of didn't realize that they were linked together. And I don't know if we're going to say what that – I said
yes,
it earlier.
Yes,
I, oh, okay, because it's like 300 people, Goliath awaits, air toxic, beware, and then Mackenzie. Oh, who's Mackenzie? But it's actually beware Mackenzie.
Yeah.
And it comes off like beware – you know, yours truly, Mackenzie.
That's right.
Sort of is how they take it, but it's actually beware, which is a lovely. I love when they do that, where it's like, you know, just we missed a little bit of punctuation or a pause or something there, and we got it wrong. So that's a lovely moment.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk really quickly about. I don't know if either one of you have read Nathaniel Hawthorne's novella Benito Cerino.
Oh no,
I haven't read that one. Huh?
So he's very verbose, and I'm not sure I'm in love with Nathaniel Hawthorne, but I read one of his stories, and I'm just doing this off the top of my head, and I think maybe Dan said something that made me think about it, or maybe go, I can't remember exactly what you guys said to make me want to reference this, but Benito Cerino is about a white captain, who I think he's a captain, who ends up on a ship, and he's not a part of the ship, like something happens with his ship or something, and so he ends up on this other ship who either rescues him or maybe he's visiting for some reason, and there's slaves on the ship, and I don't want to say too much about it, but there's all this stuff that he's being told that when you go back and think about it, it's that beware Mackenzie. It's like it has a different meaning than what he initially ingests the meaning as. And then you find out that something else is happening on the ship with the slaves. And it's really fascinating and dark and disturbing and moving. And it's a really great story. And so when you were talking, I wish I could remember what one of you said that made me think about it. But it's about how everything is not what it seems, right? And sometimes you see things the way you want to see them and not the way they really are.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things about them when they came down, especially Robert Forster's character, once he realizes there's people on the ship, he's all about helping them, right? And I think at first, I mean, they do become very skeptical as it goes on, but I think at first they really want to see the best in everybody, right? And so they don't understand these things that are happening with Mackenzie, but then everything starts to take on double meanings, right, as the film progresses. And then both Harmon and Forrester's characters start to recognize that there's something way more sinister happening and that they have to get off the ship, right? And I love that, because if you go back and watch it a second time, maybe a better reference, since I don't know if everybody's read Benito Cerino, would be Barton Fink. Because if you go back and rewatch Barton Fink, you really can tell what's happening, because there's all these clues that are telegraphed in the dialogue between John Goodman's character and John Turturro's character that you don't pick up the first time you watch it. But then when you know how it's going to end, you're like, oh, hey, that's really interesting.
It's really that's one of the things, like, I apart from a few problems here and there, it's really like a well-written and well-structured script. I mean, they really did a nice job putting it together. Oh, I'm sorry. I've got one thing I want to ask, and I'm Scotch boilers. What do we all think of Scotch boilers?
There's something that stood out to me, because I'd never heard of them, and it just, my first thought was, is this like a still, like in the Waltons with the Baldwin sisters or something, where they're making scotch, probably green scotch made from seaweed or something to match the wine.
Well, first of all, you made a Walton's reference, and I love you forever. The Baldwin sisters, I was like, oh, yes, I love them. I don't remember the Scotch boilers, I have to be honest, so you'll have to tell me.
The joy of Mackenzie, I think, well, I don't know if joy is the right word, but one of the cool things about Mackenzie is that he has this sort of godlike thing, and everyone loves what he's doing, but he's also, like, constantly patching all these bits that, like, we're going to fall apart here, we're going to fall apart there. And when he tells everyone how they survived, he says, we were saved by the fact that the Goliath had Scotch boilers. And I don't know what that is. That sounds like maybe like a haggis or something that you don't want to really eat, kind of thing. I don't know what it was. But Scotch boilers are actual boilers. I think the Titanic had them.
Oh.
And they're like really – because they mentioned all like the smokestacks or whatever on top of the Goliath. And the Scotch boilers are like really heavy duty things. Now, I went online and thought, let me read about Scotch boilers and I can tell you all about them.
It turns out that my ability to learn about boilers on ships is very limited. I got about two paragraphs into reading and I was like, I'm so bored. But I actually Googled Goliath Awaits Scotch Boilers and didn't come up with much. I was hoping I'd get the link because he very much goes in there saying, all right, we survived because of the Scotch Boilers. I was like, of course, Scotch Egg? No, Scotch Boilers.
Yeah.
And so it's, I one of the things about the movie is that I am completely convinced by all the sort of technobabble that they have in the movie about pressurization and Scotch boilers and how they did this. I don't know if any of it's true. but one of the things with a movie like this is you hope you accept it.
Right.
Because if it feels off, then you're going to spend the whole movie like looking at Frank Gorshin and hoping he doesn't speak. Hoping he just gives you that evil look.
I think now that I'm thinking about my review of the book, for this movie, I do think that they actually did a lot of research. I feel like the director actually brought on a consultant for some of the stuff that they were doing to make it more realistic. That's my memory now. Although when I redid the research this time, I don't remember. I remember then coming across news articles that were actually about some of the science of Goliath the Waits. Now I didn't see anything, and I'm not sure why, but I think maybe that was Google newspapers, and now I'm using newspapers.com, and maybe they're just pulling up different entries. But, like, I do think that they did bring on a technical consultant. Now, whether or not any of this is actually real, I think they did have somebody come on to help make it sound real, at least. And it does. Like, a lot of it sounds like, hey, look what he did. Okay. I'll buy it. And something else you brought up about it being such a good story and structured so well is that I was positive that Goliath Waits must have been adapted from a novel because it is so intricate, but it wasn't. This is a full original story.
Yeah.
And I'm really impressed with the level of detail that is in that because I'm not saying TV movies don't go into any level of detail, but they don't always have a lot of time to do it. Here they get 3 hours, so that helps. But like, they really kind of thought about a lot of the ins and outs, like, because there is like a long sequence of them going through the Goliath and sailing. This is how we did this. This is how we did that. This is what these people do here. This is what we do here. And it was really, really well thought out. And to the certain kind of minutia where you do believe that it could happen, even if a lot of the science is pseudoscience. And so the people who put this together, and I'll talk a little bit about them just briefly, they did an amazing job with that. You know, creating universes are really hard, especially I think in novels it may be easier because you have a lot more time and also you have the reader's imagination, which helps. And you don't actually have to create a visual yourself. You can lead the visual, but you don't have to fully create it. But when you're making movies, especially a TV movie where your budgets aren't going to be as high as like George Lucas gets or Spielberg, to create a universe like you do with Goliath the Waits is really impressive, I think.
Yeah, they did. They actually did really well with a lot of the production values as well, which was quite surprising for a TV movie type thing. I mean, the model work, you know, with the when they use little models of things, was quite good, you know. And and the opening part when you've got the torpedo hits and then you've got the water gushing through was actually really quite impressive. You know, it's not what you'd expect for something on a really small budget. I mean, they also took some shortcuts and used footage from, I don't know whether it's stock footage or other movies, like you've said, but apart from that, they did quite well, and the interiors and that were good. I think I read online that they'd used the Queen Mary for some of them, but whatever they did, whether it was that or whether they dressed somewhere else up, when they, like the swimming pool with all the plants and things, that looked really good. You know, they did a really good job of making it believable for what it was.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful looking movie. I don't know, Dan, did you want to add to that?
I think you guys have said most of what I thought. I was always convinced by what was going on, whether it was the submersibles, whether it was the interior of the Goliath itself. Yeah, they do a really nice job. I don't know what the budget on. I mean, I imagine on miniseries, I would imagine they had probably more, but I don't know that. I'm just making that up. But I was convinced. I mean, I still don't like Mark Harmon's mustache all that much. I don't think it was a budget thing. Maybe that was
to be honest, when he's wearing those trousers, I don't think anyone's looking at the mustache.
You know, I'll be honest, I didn't notice that at all, and I don't know what that says about me, but there were a couple of scenes where Robert Forster was in his uniform, mm-hmm. and he had his back to the audience.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I did notice that. So I guess I was looking at something else.
Can I? There was the one thing with Mark Harmon. Well, he's a bit of a strange character in this because he – setting aside his dealings with Emma Sam's character, he is the one as the movie goes along and Robert Forster's character is becoming he's implacable, the word. I don't know. He's very he keeps it together at all times.
Yes.
You know, there's a moment where, like, right at when they're about to rescue everyone, you know, Mackenzie reveals that he has the diplomatic pouch and reveals what's on it. And it's like, whoa, okay, that could be a problem. And so I want you to tell them that none of us want to go to the surface. Tell your president this. And Robert Forster basically says, yes, sir. Okay, sir. All right. Well, I think that request is contemptible, and I'm going to speak for my president and say no. And it's very nice because it's like, who's, you know, apart from Peter Cushing, who can sort of stare down Christopher Lee? Apparently, it's Robert Forster. which I completely bought, but Mark Harmon's character I think becomes tricky because as you get into like the last hour and they're trying to evacuate everyone, Robert Forster is very much like, okay, folks, here's what we have to do. You're going to go in the water. It's just going to be for a little bit of time. Hold on to the rope. You're going to get here. But Mark Harmon's character is just like, and I'm going to back up from my mic slightly. He's always kind of in the back like, we got to get off of here. What are you doing? And he's always yelling. And it's like the closer you get to the end of the movie, the more he's like, people are like, no, we're not going to go. Are you crazy? You have to go. And it's just gets so weird that they chose to have this character who at the beginning, Robert Forster's like, maybe your health isn't so great. Maybe you shouldn't be here. And by the end, he's like, he's yelling at these people who have been here for 20, 30, 40 years, you know, and it's just a strange choice that, I mean, I guess he's anxiety and panic, obviously, but it's a strange choice that they had him do. He gets more histrionic as he goes towards the end. And then he kind of jeopardizes everyone by going after Emma Sams. And
it's funny that you said that because you said in an email to me that he does have these histrionics. And then I was like, oh, I don't know if I remember that. And then I started to think back through the movie and I was like, yeah. Oh yeah. Yes. Yes. I agree. Like I could start to think about the moments where he does that, but I guess that's why he wasn't right for the Navy. Right. Because he is, emotion comes before everything else, where I think in Forster's characters, they work well together, but Forster's whole point is that you're right. He keeps his cool through everything. And he kind of, on the toss of a dime, can like figure things out, like what the solution is for every problem. Whereas Mark Harmon, I think, is being more led by his heart at this point. So I guess that's why they have it that way.
I think one of the things I found slightly amusing about that whole thing is that I think Emma Sams thinks the same about Mark Harmon, because at the end when he's rescuing her and he's got her over his shoulder because she's unconscious and he's running around corners and swinging around, you can see she's actually got her elbows around her ears, even though she's unconscious, because there's a good danger she's going to have her head whacked on one of those walls.
Oh, Emma. So I think maybe since we started, Dan brought up the evacuation, we should talk about the end. And so we're going to be spoilery here, because I think it's important to talk about what happens to some of the characters. Because I think that, so what happens is they start evacuating people, but there is like a handful of people who refuse to leave, including Christopher Lee, because for whatever reasons. One, because they're buying into Christopher Lee's jargon that they're going to be freaks. I guess Wesker kind of starts that sort of idea that they're going to be in cages and that people are going to want to come and like poke sticks at them or whatever, because they're these freaks that came from under the water. And so some of these people are really kind of buying into that. And there's one guy, I don't even know the character's name. He only really shows up at the end, but he keeps saying, I'm going to wait for Mackenzie, right? Like, and like, he'll lead us, he'll tell us what to do. And also he's built this heat thing that's going to keep us going. And Mark Harmon keeps saying, no, it's not. It's going to destroy you. It's going to explode the ship and you're going to die. And yet they choose to stay. But it's interesting because you can see why Mackenzie stays back. But then there's a couple of very important characters who stay on the ship as well. And that includes Dr. Goldman, who's Jean Marsh. And that was really sad. But you could tell that, like, it was sort of penance, right? For all the things that she had let slide. Because she does confess to Alex Quart's character. He comes up to her and he's like, you know that bad things are happening on this ship. Why are you letting this happen? And she's like, I didn't know what to do. You know, I just looked the other way, she says. And so she feels like all that guilt that she'd been suppressing all those years on the ship.
Yeah, very poignant, yeah.
Yeah, I have to stay behind.
I'm going to have to help you put this on.
No, I've decided to stay.
Why?
This will be easier to deal with.
Easier than living?
For me, yes.
Come on, get into this. You can always kill yourself later.
No, Doctor. I really have decided.
I believe you.
And it's really heart-wrenching because even though Dr. Goldman does do these things that I think are really difficult to understand, you still really like the character.
I think a lot of that is to do with her performance as well, though. I do think a lot of credit is, that's what I was saying earlier, I think if someone else had done that who hadn't have been Jean Marsh, there's a danger that you could have just think, oh, okay. But because of the way she gives that person kind of humanity, in a way, the way she brings that character to life, you do kind of feel for her, even though, you know, even despite all of that.
Yeah, it's really kind of a difficult moment for me to watch in the film. But the one that really breaks my heart is John Carradine. So at the very end, they can only get so many people per those little mini submarines. And so they have them all lined up. And Bentley is the character's name, played by John Carradine. He goes and he's helping them, right? Get everybody in line and keeping them calm. He's sort of the calming force on this ship, right? He's good with everybody. He's very likable. Again, he's an older person. I guess he does serve a purpose because of the children, right? He's always performing for the children and stuff and keeping them occupied. At the end, they've gotten everybody. I think even Riker's gone, which would be the Duncan Rieger guy. I think everybody's gone, and Carradine's left, and Robert Forster says to him, I think it's Robert Forster, he's like, it's time for you to go. And he's like, no, I'm going to stay behind. Well, why, right? And he said, well, because people are used to the way I am when I was on these films and this virile young man, and I might as well just keep that going. And my time is done, and I'm here, and I'm ready to die. And you're just like, oh my God, this is really ripping my heart out. Number one, because this moment for me in John Carradine's career, I think is a really interesting moment, because at this point he was doing a lot of B movies and he was sort of becoming like the guy who showed up for 2 seconds in a movie because that's all they could afford it for him. And here he's given a really amazing role that allows him to show what a wonderful actor he really is. And I'm not saying that in those B movies he's not great, because he is, but this is a film, I think, in a way, I don't want to say it's his targets, but it's a movie that comes sort of in that era where he was being put into these lower budget films, being allowed to show what a tremendous actor he really still was. And so that end for him is like, because he's such a lovable character, you're like, no, you got to go. And you think they're going to convince him, but they just let him make his decision. And he goes and joins everybody else who decides to stay on the ship, right? Mm-hmm. And it's so hard. But then there's also this really weird moment sort of in between the rescues where one person freaks out and they jump in the water and then there's like chaos.
Yeah.
And you're like, I think that's just there for filler, because I don't fully understand why they're freaking out. And then they stop freaking out, right?
Yeah.
And then they...
It's a disaster film thing, I guess. You gotta up the tension every once in a while.
Yeah, you can't figure. And did you guys recognize that the little boy that goes first is Kirk Cameron?
Oh yes.
Yeah. And he's really good in it. You know, he's adorable, but he's not in the rest of the film. It's just so funny to have this kid sort of, because the little girl's in it with the couple who work in the aqua room. But like, he just shows up with his grandmother or somebody, and then he's like, he has a little conversation with them, and then he goes, and that's it. And you're like, that's Kirk Cameron, guys.
Yeah.
And he's like seven. I had no idea he'd been acting for something. And I'm so glad he saved Christmas. Have you guys seen that movie?
Yeah.
No. Yeah, it's something else. Yeah.
Oh,
he turned out to be something else, but he was a really cute kid.
Thank you, Kirk. Remember when his best friend was named Boner?
I do. That's right. That's right. I used to love that show so much. So most of the people that we follow through the story get off the ship, and then after everything happens, and then there's that scene where like they have to wait for Mark Harmon to get Emma Sams because she can't figure out whether or not to stay behind or go because her dad has stayed behind, and that's also really poignant because he goes to the aqua room and he's just kind of by himself, right? And that's something that I think has haunted him, this idea of being alone and that everything he created was going to disappear, right? And so it's kind of a sad moment. But Emma Sams decides to go with them, you know, go with Mark Harmon's character and to live. And I think Mackenzie wanted her to go on and everything. So the very last shot of the film is so poignant because they come up, right, from underneath the sea and she sees the sun for the first time.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's kind of where the movie ends, right? Mm. And she just is like, it's beautiful. And it's just this really kind of sweet ending to the film, even though everybody at the bottom just like fucking died.
Blew up. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. You know, so it's got this really interesting ending. And what did you guys think of the ending?
It was fine, but I was kind of waiting to know what happened next. I wanted to know what happened, what they made of this new world where, you know, people don't do the Lambeth Walk and stuff like this, and they don't play as awful records. But also where people have clothes that wear out after 40 years and don't fall, you know, and this sort of thing. But I'd love to know, and I'd also love to know what the world makes of them. Although it would be interesting because they have the fastest news service I've ever seen. Like in one scene, somebody will mention there's 307 people down there, and then it's on the news. So it's like, how did he get there that fast, and how are they telling the news? But I would have really loved to know. I was really curious to know what happened next. That was all. It's just, it ended, and it felt like it was a good place to end it, but I was just wanting to know a bit more. That was all.
That's the sequel, Goliath Awaits 2. This time is personal.
Yeah, it would have been a very different genre, I guess, part two. Introducing these people to our world, as it were, and because I think is it Mark Harmon or I forget one of them when they talk about the music. What's the music like up there? Well, we have disco or something. And I thought, well, maybe in 81, you're a little, you do have disco technically, but you're phasing out of the disco. I'm sorry.
Well, even just color film, right? Like television, could you imagine all of the stuff that would have been so new to them just in like the 40 years that had passed?
Yeah.
And they would have gone up and watched someone would have showed them an episode of Dallas or something like that.
Dynasty or Dynasty. That would be funny. Yeah. Sam's watched that. Yeah. That would really freak her out.
Oh, yeah, because she's on it, right? Yeah. She replaced Fallon from the It later on. That's funny. That's her going to be on General Hospital or just started on General Hospital. So Emma Sams, this movie actually caught a couple actors right before they really broke out because this was Mark Harmon before St. Elsewhere, but after 240 Roberts. So, like, he was known to audiences, but he wasn't famous yet, you know. The same with Emma Sams.
And I was going to say, I forget which episodes of Battle of the Network Stars Mark Harmon is on, but he kicks ass on all of them. And that's the Harmon way.
He's actually quite a good actor. I think the thing about Mark Harmon that gets overlooked is that he is so good looking that I think people forget how talented he is. And And I talk a lot about actors who use TV movies to escape the sort of pigeonholing that they got in. And Mark Harmon really did it when he played Ted Bundy in The Deliberate Stranger, which came after St. Elsewhere or during St. Elsewhere, where people were like, it was his Legend of Lizzie Borden, right? Where people were like, oh my God, this is really an amazing performance. And I had no idea that Mark Harmon was like this talented. I think it opened a lot of people's eyes to exactly how talented he was.
Mm.
So, I don't know, is there anything else we want to add?
I think
jeez, I think I do have a note here that I call Senator Bartholomew Senator Chest Pain, because whenever big happens, he says, "Oh my god!" I can't say enough great stuff about Jean Marsh. Apart from Upstairs, Downstairs, which I watched growing up on public television, she appeared on Doctor Who 3 times.
Yes,
she played Lady Joanna, King Richard the Lionheart's sister in the Crusades. She played a sort of companion, Sarah Kingdom, who was very much like an Emma Peel kind of character in the Dalek Master Plan, and she played Morgaine, as in Morgaine from the Arthur legends, in Battlefield in 1989. So she was in the show in like 65, 66, and then in 1989.
Wow.
And so she was also on the 9 to 5 sitcom. Hey,
was she really?
Yeah. I think she's like the sort of not evil, but sort of the conniving secretary kind of to the boss, if I remember correctly.
I don't want to rewatch those. Now, which version of it? Was she on both versions? Because, you know, they had a network version and then a syndicated version.
I think it was the network version, but she may have been on both. I'd have to double check that.
I have to look at that.
Yeah, and she was in Great Tales from the Dark Side, too.
Ooh, which one was that?
I haven't watched it in a little while, but it's something like she gets a new apartment in like New York City, and I think she gets like weird phone calls. I meant to look it up before, but it's basically like just her in a room for the entire time, like, and something is like bothering her. It's either like strange phone calls or like the people in the next apartment making weird noises. I forget, but she's very good in it.
Oh gosh, I'll have to check that out. So, Gore Blimey, is there anything you want to add?
No, not really. I think we've sort of covered everything, actually, that we were saying. It was an interesting one. It's probably one that I wouldn't have thought to watch otherwise. We used to get some miniseries over here. Some of the big ones we had over here, we had things like, Scruples and Lace and Roots and, you know, some of the really big ones made over here, but not all of them. I don't know whether this one did or not. I can't remember whether this one did. I mean, it may be like with the TV movies. We don't have a big culture of them over here, which is why I quite like listening to you guys talk about the actors and things in it, because it's, you know, it's a lot of these people I might recognise, but I don't really know the names of and things like that. So, so it's an interesting experience to do, watch one of these miniseries.
Okay, well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. I thought it might be a movie you'd liked, so that's why I wanted to have you on here. And it's great to talk to people who don't necessarily have a frame of reference for TV movies. I'm really fascinated by that. And it's interesting because when I go to England and I do talks about TV movies, that's what I hear. I hear, well, we don't really have them, but you guys kind of do. It's just not to the degree that had them, to the degree that America had them. And a lot of them were released theatrically, like Duel and Is It Stranger in Our House, which became Summer of Fear. I can't remember which the theatrical title was for that. That Wes Craven one with Linda Blair. That played theatrically, Terror at London Bridge. But you have a couple, and it's interesting because there was a TV movie that came out, I think, in the early 90s. And I'm only thinking of it now is because I was in Birmingham, and somebody told me that there weren't really British TV movies. But then René Auberjonois passed away, and I remembered a British TV movie he was in called The Lost Language of the Cranes.
Oh, yes. Yes, I remember that.
Amazing film, right?
Yeah.
And kind of controversial, I think. I think it only aired once over there, and then it came out on video here, which is how I saw it. But, like, so you guys do have them. It's just, and of course, The Woman in Black, right? They exist.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're just, like, not on every night or even once a week or once a month.
Yeah,
right?
And certainly not part of like a series like you've had them, like the weekly movie kind of thing. We'd never really had that. Plays, but not movies.
Yeah, that's interesting because people have been bringing, and I want to start watching some of those, like Play for Today, I think is one of them, right?
Yeah.
That was a thing in England. Those anthology programs. We had versions of that here too, like U.S. Steel Hour. And some people consider those to be TV movies because they are feature length. But there's a fine line, I think, between what is a TV movie and what is like a play for today. And I don't actually know what that fine line is, but I do know that people make that discrepancy. And so, like, maybe I need to look at that more. But I will tell you, one of the reasons why you might not have ever seen Goliath Awaits, and I'm not positive of this because I don't know the whole history of Operation Primetime, but this was produced by a company named Operation Primetime. So I don't know if you guys did any research. You noticed that this didn't air on a network. It aired in syndication.
Oh, yes.
And that's
I saw that.
Yeah. That's what makes it really unique. So Operation Primetime was a company that was had this really neat business model. So basically what they did was they went to network affiliates, meaning not ABC in New York, but like the ABC station that was, you know, in Kokomo or whatever, and also independent stations, and they offered them a chance to help produce films. Now, I'm doing this off memory, but so what happens is I think Operation Primetime co-produced these ventures with big studios, but also with these small stations. And what would happen was, is that a lot of these channels were looking for competition for primetime or some alternative to the primetime programming. And so they would put in some money, and then they would get first dibs to show these films. And then I think the films would go to pay cable afterwards. So Goliath Awaits, what would happen was, so a bunch of different channels from all over the country. And there was another company that produced this along with Operation Primetime. It was Columbia Pictures Television, I think. They all put in a little bit of money, and then they built the budget, and then they made the movie, and then all of these channels had an option to air it. And some of what's interesting is that some of the affiliates were network affiliates, and they would actually preempt their programmings from the networks that night to show these miniseries and movies that Operation Primetime was producing. Oh. So it was a really, really interesting business model, and it was meant to create a fourth network. And it's and so I guess Dumont would be the Dumont channel would be the yeah. or DuPont is it Dumont would be the
it's Dumont. Dumont.
Yeah, that would be the first fourth channel. But I think Operation Primetime would be one of the early like attempts to create another fourth channel, and then Fox came and they really did create a fourth channel. But it was a long time coming. And so Operation Primetime usually did what we would call, I guess, prestigious programming, because they did things like, do you remember Sadat with Louis Gossett Jr., Dan? I don't know if you remember
that. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. They made that. I actually watched that, even though I had no idea who Sadat was, and I still really don't. but I love Lou Gossett Jr.
Sure.
And I remember watching that entire miniseries. They did Helen Keller, The Miracle Continues, which is sort of a sequel, right, to the Helen Keller story. And they also produced weekly TV series, which you would have seen in syndication, including Star Search and Solid Gold, which I didn't know till wow. I just started researching it this summer. Yeah, so they were doing really well. But they also did quirky TV movies, like they did The Girl, The Girl, Watch and Everything, with I think it was Pam Dauber, yeah. right? I can't remember who
yeah,
the
Yeah, Robert Hayes, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah. Yes.
Those were fun, and they
did,
I remember those.
Yeah, they're good. And they did, those are based on books. And they did a TV movie that I love called Mom, The Wolfman and Me. And everybody thinks that it's about a wolfman, but it's really about David Burney being exquisitely beautiful with this big, beautiful full beard, wooing Patty Duke, you know. And it's told from the Patty Duke's daughter's point of view. It's a really, really great sort of romance movie. And so they were a really interesting sort of corporation. Yes, I'm right. It was Columbia Pictures Television co-produced this with Operation Primetime. So Columbia Pictures Television also did another TV movie the same season called Family Reunion, with which starred Betty Davis, and it aired on NBC. So they also produced network programming, Columbia Pictures Television did. When I was doing some research on this, I came across a review by John Kenneth Muir, who's a really interesting writer. And it's funny, he reviewed Goliath Awaits. And what's so funny is I read the review, and then I was reading the comments, and there was this comment on there that said, "Ooh, I really need to see this because I love Emma Sams." And I was like, gosh, that's something I would say. That was my comment. I left that comment like 10 years ago. So I discovered Goliath Awaits through John Kenneth Muir's website. So he wrote a review of it. So something he said that I made a note of, and Dan, or maybe Gore Blimey, I don't know if you guys watch Twilight Zone at all, but he said that it reminded him of a Twilight Zone episode from the fourth season called On Thursday We Leave for Home, which starred James Whitmore, directed by Buzz Kulik, who did Bad Ronald. And the basic story is it's about the first human space colony that's about to be rescued from a forsaken planet that they've been on for 3 decades, but their leader's having a hard time accepting that change will happen when they get back to Earth. Very similar, right? So he compared the two. Unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to watch that Twilight Zone, so I was hoping maybe one of you guys had seen it. Have you?
No, sadly not.
Probably about 8 or 9 years ago. I would actually say yeah. That's it. It has kind of a very similar feel to it. Yeah. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah. No. That's. I agree.
Okay. Cool. Yeah. So if Twilight Zone fans, or if anybody wants to check that out, you might want to watch that episode in this with it. And I wish I'd had time. I'm kicking myself. I really wanted to watch it, but. And like Gore Blimey said, this was shot on the Queen Mary. Some of the bow people were actually played by Queen Mary employees, which is really fun.
Oh, wow.
And according to Jean Marsh, some of the cast and crew actually stayed aboard the Queen Mary during the filming. So there was contained. That probably helped, actually, for the, because the movie's very contained, right? So I guess to keep everybody kind of contained while they're shooting it probably added to it, maybe. Yeah. It didn't get great reviews. Cecil Smith of the LA Times said it was hokum. He said Harmon is like a white knight in flippers. But you know, Cecil Smith is very bitter. If you go back through the archives of the LA Times, you might find that he sometimes writes things like that. And they're pithy, but I don't always agree with them. Yeah. So the thing about Operation Primetime is that because it aired in syndication, it could air on any night. So I think that the IMDb page has it listed as the original air date being November 11th, 1981, the first night of airing. I'm guessing November 12th would have been the second night. But that's just in, I think, the major channels, meaning New York, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, because I think it could have aired on anytime once the affiliate or the independent station bought it. I think they could choose what night they wanted to air it on. But because it did premiere in three cities on the same night, it did really well in the ratings. It got in New York a 16.0/24, in LA it got a 16.9/26, and in San Francisco it got a 19.7/31, which basically means that a quarter to one third of audiences in America were watching Goliath Awaits on the night it aired, which is really impressive for an independent production not airing on network television. Now those are all numbers that were reflective of the first episode. I couldn't find numbers for the second episode. It did win a Golden Reel Award for Best Dialogue Editing in a Special. That was awarded by the Motion Picture Sound Editors. I personally think it should have won for art direction, and we'll talk a little bit about the art director here in a second. But so now it did air in England on ITV via something called Yorkshire Television. Do you know Yorkshire Television?
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
Okay, it landed in the top 10 in many different regions in the UK. So what I will tell you about the ratings in England, from my understanding, and maybe you know too, Gorblimey, is that they don't do it, well, so I guess it's UK ratings, right? So it's a bunch of different countries pushed together. And then the ratings are done by region instead of as a whole. Does that sound right to you?
That sounds, I don't know, but that does sound quite likely because, that sounds like how it would be done. Yeah.
So like in South England, I don't know, I can't remember how they've split it up. I guess the Midlands, right, or whatever might be separate from something else. And so it might be number one in one region, but it might be number three in another region, right? And so it was hard to understand the numbers. Plus, I think your population, I don't really know the population of the UK, but it seems much smaller than America. Is that right?
Probably, yeah. Yeah, I'm sure it would be, yeah.
Because it's a smaller area.
It's
like,
much smaller in geographically, it's much smaller, yeah.
Yeah, a friend of mine just contacted me. He lives in London, and he was telling me that he was in York recently. And I said, oh, how far is that? And he said, oh, it's a two-hour train ride. And I was like, well, that's like almost going across all of England. Because you can do that in like 3 or 4 hours. Like, it blows my mind that you can go across the entire country, right? For here, you would just get to Dallas. Like, you'd still be in the state of Texas, right? But you wouldn't be able to get out of the state. So, I mean, that's how small England is. So the numbers, I don't fully understand how they read them, but I will tell you that it did really well in the ratings. It came in number one, and it was part of ITV's highest-rated program for that week. I think the highest-rated program was Live and Let Die.
Oh,
for the month of June. So it aired in June of 1982. And it ran against on BBC One, the 9 o'clock news, and on BBC Two, something called Butterflies. Does that sound familiar?
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's a sitcom.
Yeah, that's a sitcom. Yeah.
So
that's what it ran against. It was interesting that all this stuff came up for the English. I don't often get that when I do my research, but apparently it was popular enough to have some sort of notice in the UK, trade papers. As Dan mentioned, Kevin Connor, who's the director of this, such an interesting choice, right? Because he did Motel Hell the year before. And that's a completely different film. I think he's primarily a TV director, but he did do a lot of those movies you were talking about with Doug McClure and stuff. And maybe he did TV later. But he often worked with John Ratzenberger. As you noted, John Ratzenberger was also in Motel Hell, but he was also in Warlords of the Deep and The Arabian Adventure, which were also directed by Kevin Connor. Also, I think Kevin Connor directed an episode of Wizards and Warriors titled Dungeons of Death, which also featured John Ratzenberger. So they were buddies, which is really cool. I think Connor is also a British filmmaker. I think he was born in London.
I believe so.
Yes. Yeah, he began his career working on documentaries in England. His first film was with Amicus. He did Tales from Beyond the Grave.
Oh, right.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I love those films, yes.
It just occurred to me, have you guys seen The House Where Evil Dwells?
I haven't seen that one.
Yeah. Oh, yes, yeah. Yes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's with, Eddie Albert's son.
Eddie Albert Jr., yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Edward Albert's in that. It just occurred to me. But
with
he's
the Samurai Ghosts.
It's a weird movie. Yeah. I love it, though, because I used to play on TV when I was a kid all the time, and I just loved it. Connor is best known for his miniseries work. So he did North and South, Book 2, Great Expectations, Marco Polo. I remember Marco Polo. That was huge when it aired. So he does a lot of this kind of epic filmmaking, but I think Goliath was his first miniseries. What's interesting is that this would be the last screenwriting credit for... So there were three people involved with creating the story. So Hugh Benson, I think, did the story, and then I think he might have been one of the screenwriters, but the two main screenwriters were Richard M. Bluhl, and somebody named Pat Fielder. They mostly did episodic television. This would end up being their last screenwriting credit, and also I think their last production credit, so they both also came on as producers. But I think Hugh Benson was the big name attached to it. He did a lot of TV movies. He produced The Eyes of Charles Sand. He did something called A Fire in the Sky with Richard Crenna, which is also kind of an epic sort of TV movie, although that's not a miniseries, that's a TV movie. He did Contract on Cherry Street, which I think starred Frank Sinatra, and Shadow of a Stranger, which was directed by Richard Friedman, who did Eric Phantom of the Mall. And that's kind of an interesting TV movie with Parker Stevenson and Emma Sams, by the way. The art director was a guy named Ross Bella, who had been nominated for an Oscar. He worked on a movie called The Solid Gold Cadillac, and that's the only note I made about him, but I wanted to make a note of the art direction because it was so good and so consistent throughout the film and really helped create that universe. And he did a really amazing job on this. Oh, what I forgot, I said that this came from Mark Harmon after 240 Robert, but before Seeing Elsewhere, but he was actually on a nighttime soap called Flamingo Road with Christina Rains and Morgan Fairchild.
Yeah,
I don't know if you guys have seen that, but it's really good.
Yeah, I remember it because I think one of the times he was on Battle of the Network Stars, it was I think Christina Rains even may have been on that episode. And I want, because I remember Flamingo Road showing up, and I was like, I don't remember that. And I looked it up, and I was like, okay, I vaguely remember that. Yeah.
The thing about Flamingo Road is that I grew up in Vegas, and we had a casino called the Flamingo, which may still be there, I don't know. And it was on Flamingo Road. And so when Flamingo Road aired, I assumed it was about that road.
Right.
And I didn't understand that other towns would have a Flamingo Road.
Mm.
So I was really surprised and disappointed that I think it takes place in Florida or someplace like that.
I think so.
And I was like, wait, there's another Flamingo Road. There's not a casino on it. I don't know what I'm looking at. So I contacted Lori Lathene, who played Maria, because I thought she might have some stuff to say about it. So she gave me a couple of tidbits. So anybody who has seen Goliath the Waits would recognize Lori Lathene immediately if you watched TV in the 80s or you watched horror movies, because she was sort of a great final girl in Bloody Birthday, but she doesn't do so well in The Prey, but she makes it through most of the film. And also Return to Horror High, right?
Yes.
Yeah, which she did with George Clooney. Yes. Was in that. And she's a very good actress. She's lovely. She's a really, really cool person. I met her in person last year at Texas Frightmare when she came out to promote the Prey Blu-ray release, which I did the commentary for, and she's really sweet. So she said, I think my death scene was a precursor to the day after, just getting me ready for the end of the world. Christopher Lee was kind and professional. I was totally intimidated because he was such a distinguished fellow, and he was my favorite Dracula. I only had a short scene with him before I died. The actor that really gave me the creeps was Frank Gorshin. His character was frightening, and every time I was around him, he was in character. And I think he got a kick out of it.
He was talking in that voice all the time.
I guess.
Oh,
yes.
That would freak me out.
So you see where she's coming from.
Yeah.
And she also said she thought Mark Harmon was really amazing. So those were her little tidbits about it. So she had a pretty good time making it, I think.
Oh, cool.
And she's been in so many things, and it's interesting the people that she knows, you know, because she was also in an after school production of The Wave. Do you remember The Wave, Dan?
I don't. I don't. I'm sorry. Oh.
It was based on that social experiment where they were trying to prove how, like, Nazis could come into power.
And oh, yes. Okay.
Do you remember that? Yeah, it's based on a book, yeah. I think. Yeah. And Bruce Davison plays the teacher, and she's one of the students. And, I mean, she's in everything. And she's, so, like,
was in the Master. She was an episode. That's she's in a right. wheelchair in an episode of The Master with Lee That's Van Cleef. Right. And is it Timothy Van Patten?
Yes, I think it's Timothy Van Patten. Yeah.
Yes, and yeah, she plays like she's in a wheelchair, and her sister is like a dancer, and her dad used to be a dancer, and he looks like National Book Award winning author John Barth. And there's some like Asian gangsters or something like that who are trying to take over. It's fun, and she's in the wheelchair the whole time, and you think she's going to rise up and dance in the end. She doesn't, but she's fun.
Yeah, that's the thing. So already with Lee Van Cleef, Christopher Lee, right, and George Clooney, like Bruce Davison. Like, she has worked with so many amazing people, and she has tons of stories to tell, and she's really great to talk to. So if you ever see her at a convention, you know, you should definitely go up and chat her up, because you're going to get a lot of great stories out of her. She's a really, really sweet woman, and I love her. So I already mentioned John McIntyre and Jeanette Nolan, who played the Bartholomew Moves, were real-life husband and wife, and that Jean Marsh co-created Upstairs, Downstairs, which blew my mind. I didn't know that till I just looked it up for this podcast. John Carradine was a super prolific actor, and so I wrote down the things that he did in 1981, which was the year that this came out. He was in The Reluctant Dragon, which I think was a Disney thing. It's a short. He was in Frankenstein Island. He was in The Nesting, which we probably might remember here.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a pretty weird little movie. He was in The Monster Club and also The Howling.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, that's all 1981. I was surprised to see that he only worked with Christopher Lee one other time. I had assumed that they had been in a lot of stuff together, and maybe I'm wrong, but the only credit
House
I could
of
find...
Long Shadows?
Shadows, yeah, that's the only credit I could find. And for some reason, I thought that they had been in a lot of stuff together, but maybe it's just because it seemed like they should have been.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
But, and as we mentioned earlier, Frank Gorshin was in Death Car on the Freeway, which we just talked about in an earlier episode, like two or three episodes back, very recently. Of course, he's best known for playing the Riddler in the Batman from the 1960s, but he was a regular in a lot of AIP productions, such as Drag Strip Girl and Invasion of the Saucer Man. He was nominated for an Emmy for his work in the Riddler, and I think I read that he was the only actor from that show to ever be nominated for an Emmy, which feels really criminal to me because everybody was so good on that show. I just don't know that people knew what to make of TV in like the late 60s. Because, like, between that and Get Smart and the Monkees, it was, like, on another plane.
Yes.
And the Beverly Hillbillies and Green Acres. Like, those were shows that were way off in left field. Talking about creating universes, right?
Yeah. Mm.
That were so bizarre that I think sometimes awards committees didn't fully appreciate what was happening with a lot of the actors on that, because they were just trying to keep up with the weird worlds that were being created. Yes. You know what I mean? That's my impression.
I think like Get Smart won like best comedy at the Emmys, I think twice.
Oh yeah, well, but
which was awesome.
Yeah, for sure. But like the Monkees, I don't think I don't think people knew what to make of it. When it first came on, it was just so off. And the Batman was like that too, you know, because it was really funny.
Yeah.
You know, and bright and colorful and smart, but it was weird. You know, it was different from the Donna Reed show or whatever had previously come before it. You know. So Christopher Lee also hosted Tales of the Haunted in 1981. So that was also something that was syndicated. I wrote about it in my book, so I won't go into too much detail. But it was Tales of the Haunted was like a novella series that only had 1 week's worth of episodes. So what it was supposed to be was where Christopher Lee would come in and host, and for 5 days, for half an hour a day, you would see a different part of a full story. And so by the end of the week, you would get the whole story. And then in the next week, they would have a new story. So it was like anthology programs that lasted, you know, for the whole week. And it only aired for the first week of episodes. And so Jack Palance starred in that story. And they've excised it for, I think it ended up going to syndication, and they ended up excising a lot of, so it's really choppy. And they took out the Christopher Lee parts, which is unfortunate. So I've never actually seen Christopher Lee's hosting gig from it. But he was supposed to be the host. I saw, and I wrote this down because I thought Gore Blimey might be familiar with it. He was in a 2000 remake of The Stalls of Barchester.
Oh, right. I've not seen the remake. I've heard of it, but I've not seen it. Yes.
Ooh, I would like to see it. Because you and I covered the Ghost Stories for Christmas.
We did, yeah.
And that was one of the episodes we talked about, and I didn't know it had been remade, so I'd really like to see that. Especially because Christopher Lee's in it. So I talked briefly about Alex Cord, who plays the doctor in this. He had a really interesting life. So he actually wanted to be a jockey when he was a kid, but he, as you can see, was a big guy. And so he became too tall. and too big for to ride the horse in as a horse racer. But he ended up joining the rodeo circuit after he dropped out of high school. He finally ended up getting a degree in literature, but he fell into acting. And he actually used his equestrian skills to get work in Western. So that's kind of how he broke into acting. He now has over 300 acting credits. He lives in Texas, by the way, in Fort Worth. And his neighbor is Robert Fuller, who played Dr. Brackett on Emergency, who's one of my all-time biggest crushes. So I think I'm going to be going to Fort Worth and looking for the two ranches that are next to each other. So when I made this list of what these actors have done, I tried to write things they did that took place in the water. So Alex Cord did two episodes of Love Boat between 1979 and 1981, which would put him back on a boat. So we didn't go too much into Robert Forster, but as I mentioned, he's one of my favorite actors of all time. He had just done Alligator the year before, so that put him in the sewer, right? and a lot of watery depths there in the cities of, I think Chicago is where that takes place. You know, Forster had a really impressive beginning to his career. He was in Reflections of a Golden Eye, Medium Cool, which is amazing. But then he did a long stretch of B-movies and a lot of television work before Quentin Tarantino cast him as Max Cherry and Jackie Brown, which he would get nominated for an Oscar for. But he did do some TV shows, and he starred in a couple of short-lived series, including Banyan and Nakia, neither of which I've seen yet. But then in after Jackie Brown, he would go on to do Karen Sisko, and I think he did that TV show that McGee produced. It was called, like, Fast Car. Do you know what I'm talking about? It was on Fox. With Tiffany Amber Thiessen. Yeah, I think he might have been in that. I can't remember. He was also on Heroes. He starred in a couple of TV movies, including The Darker Side of Terror. And then he was in a remake of Rear Window with Christopher Reeve, where Christopher Reeve produced a movie that basically, where he was able to utilize him being in a wheelchair. And he remade Rear Window. And it's a lot of people dissed it because it's obviously not going to be the Hitchcock classic. But it's really good because Christopher Reeve spends a lot of time taking you into his world of what it's like to be a quadriplegic. And there's a lot of heart in the film. And Robert Forster is the police officer that comes to visit him and check on things. And he's really good in it. So anyway, he was a wonderful actor. And he's done so many amazing things. And if you're not that familiar with him and you liked him in Goliath Awaits, then you definitely need to go on his IMDb page and just start picking and choosing films that he's in. Because you're going to get a great performance every time. He did a really good movie called American Perfect. So I met Robert Forster twice. And the first time I met him, he gave a talk. And he had just made a movie called American Perfect. It was right after Jackie Brown came out. And it was like 2 weeks before the Oscars when he'd been nominated. And he said that he made this movie that he was really proud of and that he was hoping people would see it. It ended up not getting a theatrical. It ended up coming out on video, and I rented it and eventually bought it. And it's a really weird, 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 like, serial killer kind of film. And he's really good in it. And I think Fruza Balk's in it as well. And I would recommend that would be a good one if you're not too familiar with his work. Also, he did Outside of Zona, which is another really good kind of slice of life weird film that came out around the same time. He would go on to work with Duncan Rieger, who played Riker, in a direct-to-video erotic thriller called The Banker, which I love. And if you haven't seen that, it's a lot of fun if you love, like, really light erotic thrillers. Robert Forster's character lives in a treehouse, and he's sort of this down-and-out cop who is investigating the serial killer known as The Banker, played by Duncan Rieger. And it's just really fun. So again, like I said, this caught Mark Harmon sort of right before he became really famous. Then, of course, he would go on to play Ted Bundy in 1986, which I think was a career-defining moment for him. And I think it's interesting, somebody here brought up Beyond the Poseidon Adventure. He's in that. So he did that in 1979. Yeah, so that put him back underwater just 2 years later. And that's kind of all I have for my background.
And now it's time for feedback.
Adam Gordon here. Sorry I've been away. The highlights I've missed include a significantly better cruise into terror than I was led to expect. Any movie that has Lee Merriweather having sex with one of Satan's minions, then screaming in tongues while attacking her pastor husband, can't be all bad. Death Cruise, while a solid mystery, had the wrong tone for a cruise ship. Romance was the better choice for the Love Boat format. The Valerie Harper action movies were a pleasant surprise, though her antagonists sure did make a lot of mistakes. Cotton Candy and Senior Trip were really just an adult's fantasy of high school. Senior Trip being surprisingly raunchy for TV and unsurprisingly down on New York City. Taste of Evil, a simplified version of No Place to Hide, along with the claustrophobic The Strange and Deadly Occurrence, featured the identifiable style of John Llewellyn Moxey. Gladiator, while being a compelling look at the issues of drunk driving and vigilantism, had a blindingly obvious finish. The fact that the antagonist was a complete rando confirmed that the film sided with Wall's character. A shout out to Nancy Allen as the sexy radio talk show host, but that is sort of right up my alley. Death Car on the Freeway has been a recent favorite of mine, primarily thanks to Shelley Hack, and was an excellent female empowerment film to rival the Valerie Harper entries. These two films, with its helpful lack of traffic, don't make you scared to drive around Los Angeles. Rather, they just fool you into thinking that you can make good time getting around town. A Silent Panic was a great look back at the golden era of television, and a taut, intense thriller. To this month's miniseries, Goliath Awaits from 1981. This 3+ hour film played like a dystopian Star Trek episode, hopefully not to repeat, but there was a Star Trek Voyager episode called The 37s, which had a similar premise. 37 people were abducted by aliens prior to World War II and were taken to another planet as slaves. Not only were the humans able to overcome their captors, but they developed a thriving, if low-tech, civilization of over 100,000 people. That civilization overcame greater odds than those aboard the Goliath, and yet no Hitler-like supreme leader emerged. In the episode, none of the settlers decide to join Voyager on their trip back to Earth, but there weren't any proto-Nazis running that planet, plus they had a better workers' compensation plan. In reality, the final decision to stay or go was a referendum for each individual on Mackenzie's manipulative leadership. While it's easy to say that absolute power corrupts absolutely, the movie forgot to explain why the arc of human history had to necessarily be replicated aboard the Goliath, or why Mackenzie became a murderous tyrant. Once Mackenzie became fully aware of the gravity of his situation, I wasn't surprised when he went full on Jim Jones. I came away with the impression that those in charge really feared having to pay for their crimes on the surface, rather than having some noble principle. The fact that those who remained actually died slowly of gas poisoning prior to the explosion was a symbol of their existence on the Goliath, more of a slow death rather than much of a life. There were some great touches, including the underwater sequences and the fact that the undersea culture hadn't changed one iota. Ultimately, though, this idea has been done better elsewhere. To wrap up, I have to tell you a quick story. My niece was assigned to do a movie review for her high school English class, so I suggested the Jacqueline Smith vehicle, Escape from Bogan County, covered here last January. I also lent her Are You in the House Alone?, where she got a couple citations for a background of the history of TV movies. I did point out a couple of things. The desolate landscape is a symbol for Smith's isolation, the jail cell where Smith was physically trapped between her captor and her liberator, and the sequence at the end where the panorama dissolves into Smith's picture, representing Bowman's one true regret, losing his wife. Not only did she get an A, she had her essay read aloud in class as a model paper. So, thanks again, Amanda.
Well, I think thanks to Adam. I mean, he pointed out some really neat stuff about Escape from Bogan County. Which, you know, it's funny, I watched a movie with Michael Parks last night called Heart Country, and I was hoping he'd sing, because, you know, when you remember Escape from Bogan County, he serenades Jacqueline Smith's character, and I just love it. His singing voice is amazing. Here he just plays a lecherous brother who tries to rape his brother's girlfriend in Heart Country. It's a different role. He's doing different things. But thank you, Adam. First of all, wow. Okay, so, like, in one sentence per film, he basically encapsulated everything. Uh-huh. So we can just delete those episodes off the iTunes because he can just fill everybody in. And it's interesting what he said about the dystopian universe. And also, was that which Star Trek was that? Star Trek?
Voyager.
Voyager, which I wasn't familiar with. And that might be worth checking out for people interested. The whole dystopian, utopian thing, I wanted to go into to some depth, but I didn't really have time to really research it to the degree that I felt comfortable talking about it. But I'm not sure how many TV movies, or maybe films in general, although I think it might be more a theatrical thing, where you see things that feel like a utopia, and the closer you look, it's a dystopia. Do you know what I mean? Like, that was really interesting to me. And also, I think in reality, it's almost impossible for a utopian community to survive. And I was trying to find some information about that, because there always has to be some kind of leadership. And I'm not saying there has to be a class system, but, like, we talk about how we live in a democracy, but we actually live in a capitalistic, you know, structure, right? And for capitalism to succeed, there always has to be somebody beneath you, right? And so, like, I'm not saying that you can live without full equality, but if you have a leader, then you're already developing a system of hierarchy, right? And so, well, I was curious about utopia and dystopia running together on a spectrum, but I just couldn't get into it. But I'm glad that Dan and Adam kind of sussed out that subtext as well. I thought that was really interesting. I don't think he liked it as much as we did, though, the film.
Yeah, he doesn't seem to have. That's okay, though. We still like you, Adam. Yeah.
Of course we do. And I'm really excited about that paper.
Yes.
I would love to see that. He should send it to us. And we don't have to read it on the air, but I would definitely love to read her essay.
Oh, it sounds amazing. Good for her. Yeah.
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 Really good.
And that's a deep dive, too, because Escape from Bogan County is not just a TV movie, which already makes it obscure, but it's an obscure TV movie, right? Like, it's not dual, you know? So, like, it's a movie that I bet nobody in that class had ever even heard of before. I mean, even the teacher, right? So that's a really interesting choice for a film, and I'm really glad she chose it. So thank you, Adam. I really appreciate you coming back. We missed you.
Yeah, yeah. Good to have you back, sir.
Hello, Amanda, Dan, Nate, and Gore Blimey! Yay! I cannot wait to hear you all together for this podcast. I can't imagine contributing anything you haven't already covered, so I can only voice my enjoyment. What a great choice of movie or miniseries. I'd never heard of this one, and it was awesome. Of course, it reminded me of On Thursday We Leave for Home from Twilight Zone. Though it ends much more darkly, the introduction of the possibility that there were Nazis aboard Goliath gave the hint that things could go south, and sure enough, without being blatant, it became an experiment in fascist society. In fact, did I miss something? They never actually came out and said, I don't think, that Christopher Lee was secretly a Nazi, but it seemed clear enough. Anyway, I did not expect to see Emma Sams. So delightful! My adolescent crush came rushing back for almost the whole movie until she became basically a worthless sack of potatoes at the end. How could the daughter of Christopher Lee suddenly be so weak? If only she had drawn strength from Mark Harmon's mustache. Speaking of which, I'd like to see Mark Harmon's mustache get together with Ken Wall's eyebrows for a hair-raising movie. Ho ho! Hey, hey, now. Really, my crush on Emma Sams was replaced by Jean Marsh. She was amazing, and so complex and layered. She almost made it forgivable what a sausage fest this movie was. Though, it's great sausage, to be sure. Frank Gorshin, Christopher Lee, Eddie Albert, Robert Forster, and Cliff Clavin! Although I have to admit, I was disappointed to see Kirk Cameron's name in the credits. I didn't recognize him at first, but he was the kid. And if I knew that kid was him, I would have thrown food at my screen. But I did not. So I enjoyed the movie. Now, speaking of politics, you might cut this last comment, and that's okay. But how fascinating to see a functioning fascist community, unaware of its own fascism, offered a better life by folks who represent progress. How some would choose to die along with this unsustainable fascist state rather than follow the uneasy path to the imperfect but promising future. Thankfully, most of them took a chance on hope, and I hope that that's a sign of good things to come for us. Another side note, I was actually going to try to record a Cliff Clavin impersonation and do some diving trivia that ended in a joke, but number one, I couldn't come up with a joke, and number two, my Cliff Clavin impersonation is horrible, so I did not go that route. But I did find out that there was a guy who actually did this dive. I mean, not this specific dive, but he dove 1,000 feet. Ahmed Gaber. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. He's in the Guinness Book of World Records for deepest scuba dive at more than 1,000 feet. He did it near the Red Sea. And I'm looking at this internet page because I'm trying to... It took him all day. And the thing is, he dove fairly quickly, but it took 15 hours to come back up in order to avoid the bends. So... way to go, Ahmed.
Thanks so much, Dan. There was some really interesting stuff in there, but it was especially lovely what you wrote about sort of the political kind of connotations to it and choosing hope. And like you, I kind of hope that that's a sign for us in this world, too. And that was a really beautiful way to say it. Does anybody else want to add anything?
Yeah, I want to say, hey, back. How nice is that? And I love that Stan's commented on a couple of things that I mentioned as well. So, I mean, Emma Sams being like a worthless sack of potatoes at the end.
Yes.
And referring to this as a sausage fest, brilliant. And I love the idea of some kind of a erotic movie with Mark Harmon's moustache and the somebody's eyebrows. Brilliant stuff. I'd rent that. I'd watch that.
I believe you. That's the thing.
No, that was fantastic. Thank you. Thank you, Stan. Very, very good. Very good.
Yeah, it was interesting about the dive, too, like the 15 hours to come back up. I would get so bored.
Yeah. Gosh, and you wouldn't have to – you couldn't have a book with you because you're in the water. You'd have to have like a waterproof book or something like that.
It also reminded me of how there's so many movies where people go underwater and they can somehow magically talk to each other.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which they wouldn't be able to do with the breathing apparatus, right? Like,
you would think, yeah.
But there's this really great movie called Shark Attack 2, at the end they go to, because there's a bunch of sharks, right? Like living in this cave or something, and they all dive down. I think there's two or three of them, and they're all making one-liners, like as they're diving to like 300 like sharks, and it's hilarious because you're like, well, first of all, how are you talking to each other, and secondly, why are you making jokes? Because they're gonna kill you. I think, so that was all really interesting. So thank you so much, Stan.
I'm trying to think what else.
I think Gore Blimey covered it about that. We should have talked. It was kind of a sausage fest. There were actresses in it, but G. Marsh is really the only one who got that chance to really shine. Although I do think that Emma Sams was really good in the part. I just don't know that the character was as strong as it could have been. Maybe.
Yeah. Just my thoughts.
She's amazing. I love her so much. And she would go on to be Holly on General Hospital. And so, therefore, all sins are forgiven for me. When it comes to her, she's fantastic. And so that was it for our feedback. Again, thank you, Stan and Adam. That was wonderful.
Thank you.
And I'm surprised we got any feedback at all because I posted when we were recording, but I followed up with several posts on Twitter and Facebook, but I just didn't have the time to do it this time. But I will give you a heads up on what we're doing on our next episode. So I won't tell you, we're going to have another guest. I won't say who it is, because we haven't lined up dates yet. And it's somebody else who lives in the UK. And I know it's harder for us to kind of align schedules, but we're going to try really hard at the end of March to get this person on. And we're going to do a celebration of Shannon Doherty's television movie career.
Oh, wow.
And excellent. I'm really excited about it. Yeah, we said we were going to do this when we did the Troy Spelling episodes way, way back now, that we were going to cover Shannon Doherty, and I didn't get around to it. And I feel really bad about it because I don't think I should wait till somebody has stage 4 cancer to talk about how amazing they are. But when Valerie Harper was first diagnosed with her cancer, I did a blogathon for her where I reached out to a bunch of different bloggers and asked them all to write about why they love Valerie Harper, and a bunch of people participated. And so what I'm hoping is, I haven't picked the two films yet. That's coming up. But if anybody wants to write in and talk about Shannon Doherty's career, anything, her film work, her television work, her TV movies, you come and drop us a line, because she is so amazing. She's such a badass. If anybody can survive what she is going through, she can. And so I thought this could be a really positive way to like send our love to her. And that's what we're going to do. And I'm going to try to pick two of her best TV movies. Now, two of them were already covered in the book, and those were the two I probably would have thought about doubling, but they've already been written about. Let's pick two other TV movies. So the thing is, she's done a ton of them. So I have to really figure out which ones I want to talk about. And so just stay tuned for that. And you can find out what Shannon Doherty movies we're going to cover, or when our latest episodes come on, if you follow us on our social media. So you can follow us on Instagram at Made for TV Mayhem. You can find us on Facebook at The Made for TV Mayhem Show. You can find us on Twitter at TV Mayhem Podcast, or you can go to our website, which is tvmayhempodcast.wordpress.com, or you can email us, which I believe our email is tvmayhempodcast@gmail.com. This is our shameless self-promotion portion before we leave. So about things that we've done or where to find us and blah, blah, blah. So let's start with Gore Blimey. What do you have going on?
I have loads going on at the moment, but not necessarily podcasting stuff. I mean, I'm really glad that I was able to make it here today because it's a mad week. Earlier in the week, I bit my tongue badly. I was a bit overexcited on a calmer, I think. But so it was a bit touch and go because I didn't want to end up sounding like Jimmy Jr., you know, when I'm talking to you. And you know how hard it is to speak clearly when you've got a big swollen thing in your mouth, you know. So I really didn't want to. But luckily, things have gone down since then. It's also busy here at the moment in Wales because it's St. David's Day tomorrow, which is the saint for Wales. So I expect I shall go and buy some daffodils and have a leek. So, you know, we like our national symbols here, especially the plant and vegetable ones. And of course, this week, you know, we've had Christmas, you've had Thanksgiving. We've had Pancake Tuesday this week. Is that a thing over there? I don't know if you have. No?
There's like IHOP Pancake Day where I think the pancakes are half off or free or something like that.
Not quite the same. We all join in. We at home, we all kind of make and toss pancakes in a pan, which is good. I mean, you do need to have a good tossing technique. I mean, apparently it's all in the wrist action, you know, and you need to be able to whip up good batter first. So, so that's been a busy week. But I am going to be coming back with a new episode of the podcast soon, the Trilogy of Terror podcast. And I shall be with, I won't say much about it, but I'm going to be with a guest which some people may be familiar with if you follow the kind of podcast that I follow, let's say. Someone I'm really excited to be doing a show with this episode, and that will be coming up soon. So I'm not disappeared yet. I'm still around. So that's what I'm up to. So, yes, and thank you for inviting me on to this today.
Oh, yeah, great.
Well, how can we find you? So you're on Twitter, right? So what's your Twitter handle?
The best way to get a hold of me and to find me and my sort of ramblings is on Twitter. For me, it's at I Am Gore Blimey, all one word. And you can find the podcast, I mean, apart from on iTunes and the usual podcatchers and things like this, there's also the website, which is trilogyofterrorpodcast.com, and you can find previous episodes and sort of links and things on there as well. So those are the easiest way to get hold of me or to follow me.
I love your last episode because you had an American on. Is it Johnny Knock? Did I get his name right?
Johnny Numb. Yeah, the lovely Johnny Numb from the last Knock podcast. Yes.
The last Knock. That's what it is. And he wasn't really sure if a double entendre was going to come or not. So, like, there was this really great moment where you're talking about pudding and he's laughing because I think he thought maybe there was something there. And there wasn't really. But then you started to talk about nuts in his lap for Christmas because, like, the way they string nuts on, you know, for the tree. And it was the most hilarious, like, 3 minutes I've ever heard in my entire life. I could not stop laughing. It was so good. And it was full of all those double entendres that you are famous for. So what if his name was Rubber Johnny? Because I don't know what a Rubber Johnny is.
He always says at the end of their podcast, he says he gives his details, and he always says his name is Johnny Numb, and there are no H's in those Johnnies. And it always amuses me because over here a Johnny is a condom. And has been, you know, I mean, it's now we call them condoms, but when I was growing up until the 80s, it was always a Johnny or a Rubber Johnny. And so it always sounds a bit odd when somebody says there are no H in those Johnnies, and you think, what are H's and what are they doing? So it just amused me, the poor guy. I mean, the poor.
He was a really good sport.
He was really good fun. Yeah, he's great. Yeah, had a lot of fun doing that.
You guys had a great discussion about Maniac, which I didn't really think of as a Christmas film, until you guys did it as such. And so some of the stuff you pointed out was really fascinating. So anyway, everybody check out his podcast, Trilogy of Terror. And Dan, what have you got going on?
I Venture Super Train, as always. And you and I, Amanda, are about to finish Masquerade.
finally. And which is too bad. And we're still talking. I'm still talking Bourbon Street Beat with Mitchell Hadley. And I just started talking Shadow Chasers from the mid-'80s. And also, if you go back to old episodes of Venture Super Train, you will find Mr. Gore Blimey on there. We discuss the wonderful Garth Marenghi's Dark Place and the quite wonderful follow-up, Man to Man with Dean Lerner.
We'll be delving into his dark place,
so to speak.
Yes, and of course.
And, the Adventure Super Train and my Happy Days podcast, I just started season 3, and I'm going to be doing another minute-by-minute podcast soon. I just haven't figured out what movies to talk about yet. So that's kind of where I am at the moment.
Wow, it's very good. So I guess I'll just say with the big – well, first of all, Dan and Nate and myself, we did a commentary for a Kino Lorber release called Amazons that came out in December. Which, if you're into TV movies, that's a really good one. And we had a lot of fun doing that commentary. So pick that up if you're interested. But I guess I can finally tell everybody, one of the reasons why we've had to put the podcast off for so long was that I wrote a book. And with Bill Ackerman from Supporting Characters podcast, we do a lot of projects together. And it's going to be in part of the Al Adamson box set, which just got announced by Severin, where they're releasing basically almost every 95% of Al Adamson's movies in a set. And it's going to have this book with some production history about each and every film that that Bill and I wrote. And we're really excited about it. We just saw the proof of the book, and it's beautiful and makes me even more excited about it. And it's going to be a really neat box set. I don't know if the book will be separate, but if you're into Al Adamson, I think it's a set to pick up. He was a really wonderful filmmaker, and we've always liked him. But, you know, when you work on some of these projects, you always hope you fall in love with the subject. And I am super in love with Al Adamson right now, especially Carnival Magic. I think like the craziest, most wonderful film ever. So you can just look up Severin and find that. Next month, Bill Ackerman and I are going to be on a Kino Lorber release for Pray for the Wildcats. We did the commentary for that. That's a really great movie. I'm super excited to be a part of that. And again, that comes out in March. I uploaded a new Trapcast, which is online now, and hopefully I can do them once a month. I'm not sure, but I'm going to try really hard to keep going with them. And that's it for me. And I think that's it for our episode. So thank you so much, Gore Blimey, for joining us. I really appreciated your insights about Mark Harmon's pants. What did you think of Alex Cord's mustache?
That was kind of impressive as well. I did wonder if it was real or not, but I think it was, wasn't it?
I think it was.
I think so.
Did his impression remind you of Foghorn Leghorn?
Maybe a little, yeah.
Hey, boy, come on over here. Let's have a look at you. This is a boy?
So boy? That's what I was trying to think of when we were talking about accents. So any people can listen to that. Anyway, so thanks everybody for listening. Thank you, Dan, again, for all your hard work on this show. Oh, sure. And hopefully Nate will be back with us next month. If not, we'll have a guest. And that's it. So we'll see you next time. Good night.
Good night.
Bye.